Troy. Welcome to WRAM's award-winning Night Call, Detroit's longest-running phone-in talk show with Peter Werby and Julene Jordan. Peter and Julene will be voicing their opinions, and they want to hear yours. Call them at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter and Julene.
Thank you very much, and welcome. We had last week off. Hi, Julene.
Hello, Peter. Glad to be back.
Did you do a Labor Day thing?
I did a Labor Day thing called labor.
You worked, didn't you?
Yeah.
At one of our sister stations.
Yeah.
Well, we said, and we've said this so many times before, we have one of the few jobs where we don't look forward to having the day off.
I know, definitely.
But
especially what the state, well, we've said this for years. It doesn't matter what year it is, what week it is. There's always so much going on. And when we miss a week, it's a little overwhelming.
Yeah, I thought President Obama would have already bombed Syria, but
yeah.
He played an unusual card. He's asked Congress for permission to bomb Syria because, according to him, there's incontrovertible evidence that the Assad regime in Syria has used poison gas in violation of all these international treaties and prohibitions and what have you. It's not as clear to me or to lots of other people that the evidence is all there. Obviously, the poison gas, the sarin gas, was in Syria.
It occurred.
It occurred. And horrific toll on, as has been repeated and every time that it's mentioned on the news. And have you seen the television news? That I just avert my eyes. They just show all these dead people, and they show people after they've attacked, so they're writhing in pain. And
I saw just a little
horrible
tidbit. I can't
horrible
do it.
Well, there was charges that the rebels had used poison gas in March of this year, because certainly the Syrian government, like so many other governments, including the United States government, possesses chemical weapons, including sarin. And actually, there was a lot of complicity. There was an article in the New York Times today about how these worldwide Western companies were complicit in supplying Syria with poison gas, including some U.S. corporations. So nobody really has clean hands in this, but no one has used poison gas weapons in quite a while.
I mean, Iraq
used them against Iran, and I'm trying to think if there were other cases.
And this one seems to be a little less which side of the aisle you're on. Doesn't it seem that way a little bit?
Politically?
Yeah.
Well, it's kind of flipped
in
some way.
Yeah, hasn't it?
Yeah. A prominent, and I don't want to give her any publicity at all, a prominent Republican sent out a press release calling for opposition to giving President Obama permission to bomb Syria. And I wrote her back and said, welcome to the anti-war movement.
I love it. Nice work.
Yeah. And I also wrote, though, I said, why do I think, though, if it would have been President Reagan, you would have been all over beating the war drums?
Yeah. Oh, for sure.
Yeah. I didn't hear back from her.
I was going to say, what did she write back? Dear fill in blank, thank you very much for your concern.
Right.
Blah, blah, blah.
Hey, you're listening to Night Call. Peter Werby and Julene Jordan with you. And if you'd like to join in the conversation, well, we wish you would. 313-298-WRIF is our phone number to get you on the air.
313-298-9743.
And a lot of what we say is bolstered by information on our Facebook page, which is facebook.com/nightcall, and also on my personal website, Peter Werby, WERBE.com. If you'd like to email us any... Oh, okay.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
It's okay.
I thought
you were
like, off button. No,
it's okay. If you'd like to email us, it's calltalkyes@yahoo.com. The vast majority, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I think we should talk about the actions. There was one earlier, Grand Circus Park, and they marched down to Hart Plaza against war in Syria or bombing Syria. And tomorrow there's something going on.
Sure, there is. And it's a fact it's going to be nationwide. And it's called by people that were big supporters of President Obama. Here's the guy that got the Nobel Peace Prize, right? And so they're going to be, this is called by MoveOn.org and lots of other groups as well. And this is going to be nationwide. So if you're listening anywhere in the country, maybe even in the world, you can go to my website, peterwerby.com, or our Facebook page and get all the information.
Yeah, tomorrow at 12 in Woodward, 7 o'clock here, if you're listening in the area.
It's at the same side where the Shrine of the Little Flower is.
Oh, that place. That place. Ugh. They're the ones who put up the
crosses.
The crosses.
Yeah, for
the anti-abortion crosses.
Yeah, right. So this is at the intersection of Woodward and 12 Mile Road. And as far as I know, you can actually click on the leaflet for all this on either my Facebook page, our Facebook page, or my website. And if you're elsewhere, you put in your zip code.
That's what it is.
Yeah, and then you'll find out what it is. Now, one of the arguments, this is the strangest argument, that if President Obama is not given permission by Congress to strike Syria, that it'll be a humiliating defeat for him and the United States, that our credibility will be gone, that it will encourage Iran to continue developing atomic weapons, although it's not 100% clear that that's even happening, that will have reduced clout in the world. Maybe that would be good.
Well, maybe you could look at it another way, not losing clout, but gaining some heart.
Yeah. You know, the Republicans used to be marked by what was called isolationism in like the 20s, 30s, 40s and what have you, a lack of desire to be involved in the affairs of the world to the extent that now we have 700, 800, 900. I even heard someone put it at 1,000 military facilities all around the world.
Wow.
Some of them are probably fairly small. Some of them are very, very large. I mean, we have, why do we have troops in Germany?
I know. But that's a really good question.
Yeah. Well, I don't get it.
And what are they doing? What are they doing there?
What are the United States strategic military goals? They used to be containing communism. I think there's probably good numbers of you listening, particularly to WRIF, that weren't even alive when that flawed system went bye-bye. Right?
Right.
Let me see, 1989. So you'd be, if you're 20 years old, you weren't even alive when that happened. And so what? Why do we have these Africa commands and Latin America commands and troops in South Korea and Okinawa? And I don't even know where all these other places are. I'm sure there's a list of them. Hey, jump in on this, by the way. And if there's any of you who think, yes, we should carry out. Well, you know what? I want to rephrase what
if
I said.
If anyone's before it.
No, I didn't want. I said we. And I don't like this identification with the acts of government, with what I do or you do or anybody out there listening, any of you listening, that it's government policy, it's government decisions, and it's government actions. So I guess, if there are people who think, we should strike Syria, and what will the consequences be? That's what it is. I mean, really, what's happening? It's, it's going to be another Iraq. It's going to be another Afghan. Oh, no. They said 45 days.
That's remember that?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And remember those liars, those warmongers in the Bush administration. They said, this is going to be, I think they even used the phrase slam dunk.
Yeah, I think you're right.
It's going to be a slam dunk, a walkthrough, that there wasn't going to be any resistance.
Some slam dunk that was.
Yeah. Maybe it'd be worthwhile actually reading something that's on our Facebook page and on my website. Stephen Zunis, who's been a guest on my show any number of times, let me see if I can remember. He's a professor of political science. Well, doesn't have it here. I think at San Francisco State University, right?
And University of San Francisco.
Okay. And I think his first argument probably is the weakest to most Americans. A U.S. military attack would be illegal. Yeah, so what?
They've done it before.
Yeah. I can't think of the name of the film suddenly. You know, badges. We don't need no stinking badges.
I don't know.
Yeah. why can't I? With Humphrey Bogart and,
hence my lack of knowledge.
Okay.
I haven't seen a lot of Bogie films.
Yeah, it's real good. It's from a book by B. Traven.
Okay.
And it is called, I don't know what. All right. Anyway, it is absolutely illegal under anything that the United States is signatory to attack another country that has done something internally, no matter how vile the act may have been. And again, it's not 100% clear. I don't know if you've been watching any of the news accounts. We were saying we didn't like to even look at them because of the horrific videos that they have. But it is just part of the war machine. Remember, I used to call NPR, the so-called liberal radio network.
Nationalist Public Radio.
Nationalistic Pentagon Radio.
The Pentagon, yes.
Yeah.
Right.
And so you would not know particularly that there was any coherent objection to the attacking Syria, that what they say, he Assad has done this horrible act, and if he's not punished, that he will be apt to do it again.
And but we were talking about it earlier, and you said there's talk of other groups being named for
it's possible.
Being responsible for this.
Well, there's some thought. I mean, there's all sorts of things. And again, all of this is on our Facebook page and my website. And one of the thoughts was that this, in fact, was carried out by a low-level commander. And there's audio for this. And that when the higher-ups found out about this, they were aghast and they were horrified. So it could have been, in fact, some unit of the Syrian army that went against all of the plans of the Syrian military. So, I mean, let's look at this. I mean, what interest or what strategy or goal or whatever could the Assad government have in attacking civilians, killing 500 kids and 1,000, mostly women and elderly people? What would that do for him? I mean, for one thing, he knew that Obama had already warned, say, this was the red line that can't be crossed, which, of course, now has put Obama in the position he's in. He's damned if he does and damned if he doesn't.
Yes.
And so why would they do this? Just because they're awful, horrible, evil people, and they thought, let's gas somebody in the areas that we don't
with
like.
With the gas that we sold him.
Well, we didn't sell them the gas.
But they sell them everything else.
The stuff that they could make it for. But anyway, and hey, Rick and Jeanette, hang on. And some others of you that are beginning to come on the line, just hang on. Oh, yeah, Barry Colden says, the treasure of the Sierra Madre. Famous book, famous movie, and one of my favorites. I don't know why I couldn't think of it. Maybe because I was thinking about Syria. And again, I want to keep, if you feel like the majority of American people do, that we should not get into this at all, that we don't know what the consequences on any level will be to this. We say, oh, yeah, we're going to send those Tomahawk missiles over there. Now they're talking about having to send planes as well.
Oh, see, and it's ever increasing.
And it's only going to be for 45 days, yeah. Right. But it's a U.S. military attack, according to Professor Stephen Zunis, is absolutely illegal. It's a U.N. charter. An international treaty that's been signed and ratified by the U.S. that says that only if the United States is directly attacked or feels there's an imminent attack coming on us could we respond. Also, he says there is little strategic rationale he says bombing Syria's chemical weapons stockpiles, pardon me, some of which have been placed deliberately in crowded civilian neighborhoods. This Assad is not a nice person. He's a vile, vicious dictator that's killed thousands and thousands of his own people. If they bomb this, it would release large amounts of toxic gases into the air, which could kill thousands of people. Mm-hmm. In addition, given that chemical weapons can be deployed on planes, missiles, mortars, and other ways, there is no realistic way of eliminating their delivery systems. So they're talking about trying to degrade their aerial capacity,
like it's a small task.
Yeah, and the other thing is, it's not real clear who's going to wind up in charge in Syria. It could be some Al-Qaeda.
As per usual.
Yeah, some Al-Qaeda sympathetic group. Remember, of all the loss of lives, Iraqi and U.S., of $1 trillion we spent, there's now a government there that can't control this violence that where hundreds and hundreds of people are killed regularly. And the prime minister is essentially allied with Iran. I mean, that's after all of this, right? So, let's see, a threat of a U.S. attack in the event that the Syrian regime would use chemical weapons, first put forth by Obama more than a year ago, failed to deter last month's attack. So he's threatened to do it, right? Maybe they're saying, okay, let's see if he'll really do it.
Yeah, test him.
I don't know. Military intervention likely would lead to more death and destruction. And Stephen Zunis, the history professor, says, political science professor, says, history is replete with examples of supposed limited military actions that dramatically escalated. In fact, he says, empirical studies have demonstrated repeatedly that international military interventions in cases of severe repression actually make violence in the short term more and can only reduce violence in the longer term if the intervention is impartial or neutral, which isn't happening here. And there's lots of other things, too. The United States, he says, has little credibility regarding chemical weapons. The United States had pledged to destroy the government's entire stock of chemical weapons, and we still possess them to this day. A military attack likely, says Stephen Zunis, would strengthen the Syrian regime, that the Assad regime has used external attacks to bolster nationalism.
Before.
Yeah.
So we should just get right on this. Right?
Yeah. I wonder what's happened, though. I mean, this could really result, either way, in a failed Obama presidency. But maybe it'll be failed in that we won't have the capacity to intervene continually in the affairs of other countries around the world.
Yeah.
No one else does this in the entire world except for the United States.
I'd be fine with that, by the way.
Yeah. How about you guys? 313-298-WRIF. Let's see. Here's Rick. Rick is in Farmington. He called 313-298-WRIF, and he says he knows why there's so many military bases around the world. What do you think, Rick? You're on the air.
Hey, how you guys doing? I ain't talked to you in a long while.
Good.
I've been listening.
Welcome. Hi, Rick.
But anyway, being in the military, I'm going to go on and say it and get it out there. We are the world police. Everybody expects us to do something. But I think America should just close her doors and take care of herself for once in a while. And just leave all the rest of this craziness alone, because those people have been doing crazy stuff over there for thousands of years.
You know, Rick, here's the only ambivalence I think that I have, and maybe you and others as well do. I mean, Clinton sat there and did nothing where a couple hundred thousand people in Rwanda were just slaughtered. Or, on the other hand, he intervened in Kosovo when these Kosovars were getting thumped pretty badly. But you're right. That's literally the policemen of the world. And where we got in the case of Bosnia and Kosovo, we had, you know, like NATO support and what have you. Here, where we're just deciding, okay, somebody did some bad thing, so we're going to go over and punish them.
Does anyone want to help us?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, it's that whole Somalia thing.
Forgot about Somalia. Yeah,
that old Rwanda Somalia thing, that's a whole horse of a different color. I don't even think we want to go into that.
Okay.
But all the rest of this crazy stuff, man, that's going on in those countries over there where it's got oil at.
There you go.
The underlying thing, it's all about that oil. But we, United States, we got oil. We got so much oil, you wouldn't believe it. I've been to the depot. You can look far back in there, as far as you can, and we got oil.
Well, before you go too far into that, I don't know whether you're able to stay up as late as some of these interviews, but I'm at 1 a.m. I'm interviewing someone named Richard Heinberg, who was writing about this new extraction process for oil and gas, shale oil, fracking, and all that. And we got a lot of it, but what it portends is not exactly so good. But we can talk about that later. Rick, thanks for your observations. I appreciate it. 313-298-WRIF. By the way, John is answering your phones there, and he says
we had a phone freeze.
He said the phones are glitching out, but he's trying to fix. So if you want to get on the air,
he fixed it.
Yeah. Oh, he fixed it.
Yeah.
That's good. All right. So you can call again. 313-298-WRIF. And I'm particularly looking for somebody in this. You know, I'm not going to jump down your throat. Because I don't know, maybe Jolene will.
Never.
If you call in and say, yes, we should bomb Syria, although you're probably few and far between. But, hey, very frequently, so am I, and so is Jolene. But if you actually oppose portended here with this strike and what could come of it, like there was an article saying Iran is planning retaliation
right.
with the United States.
Read that.
What could that mean? I don't know, but it doesn't sound good, does it? But you can't just think in your head, I'm opposed to it. Get out there. get out on the streets. Like Jillian and I are going to be at the corner of Woodward and 12 Mile Road tomorrow at 7 p.m. That's in Royal Oak. It's in front of a famous church. We won't even say what it's famous for, but it's the Shrine of the Little Flower in Royal Oak, 12 Mile in Woodward, 7 o'clock to 8 o'clock. Make your voice heard. All right, let's go to Will. Will's in Windsor. Thanks for making our show international. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks, Peter. Just want to make a couple of points.
Sure.
One specifically, the United Nations Security Council, I know it's very popular these days to just dismiss the UN as being insignificant or outdated, but a couple points I wanted to make. The UN Security Council with the five sitting members that have veto power, after World War II, in which we lost 50 to 60 million people, that was devised for one specific purpose, to keep the major powers that could inflict significant damage on the planet from going to war with each other. That's why they have that veto. And since 1999, with the invasion of Kosovo, it has been constantly shoved by the wayside. It's almost an inconvenience. And I think that's one of the biggest mistakes. I mean, the UN wasn't there to take us to heaven. It's there to keep us from blowing ourselves to hell. And I think that's a big lesson that is constantly overlooked. A couple other points I want to make.
Sure.
I know you already got the treasure of Sierra Madre question answered. I don't think you get press TV out of Iran. Now, it is, of course, a state propaganda channel, but it does still have some significant information on it, as well as I go to Russia Today. I go to Mint Press. I don't know. You're probably aware of some of these. But no one talks about the fact that, like in Egypt 3 weeks ago, we've already forgotten that the American-backed and Saudi-backed coup, where the Muslim Brotherhood vote, which was democratically elected, was overthrown, and they shot down 900 people in the streets just 3 weeks ago. That's been completely forgotten.
It wasn't done with chemical weapons. That's why no one's
talking about it.
Yeah.
Okay. You're right. I mean, chemical weapons are horrible things, but I mean, what is white phosphorus? I mean, that goes right through your skin and will not stop.
The United States uses it. Also used shells with depleted uranium that once it's pulverized, atomized, is toxic. Hey, Will, you're in Windsor, so you're a Canadian. How has Prime Minister Stephen Harper? I shouldn't have given that away. Probably 92%.
Who's the Prime Minister?
92% of Americans have no idea who the Prime Minister of Canada is, but he's sort of like Bush. What's his deal on the U.S. Hitting Syria? Do you know?
He is Bush too.
Yeah.
He will not go along with an attack because he knows the Canadian people are so adamantly against it, and there is an election. He has to call an election within every 6 years. That's how it works in our system. And so he has to call an election within the next 16 months, and he knows the Canadian people are just definitely not on board on this. So he has declined, just as the British have. I mean, he didn't go through Parliament. He has just declined, but he is offering all his diplomatic and encouragement and support.
Okay, good. Appreciate that information. Thank you, Will. So who's on our side? I think France.
That's it.
Well, Saudi Arabia apparently said that they... I just saw them. I should look it up rather than guessing. But I believe they said that Saudi Arabia and these other Arab nations said they believe that the Assad government ordered this poison gas attack. But again, it doesn't make a bit of sense. All it would have done would have brought this on the Assad regime. And there was nothing militarily strategic to be gained. Yeah. In fact, that some UN observers that were going to check out the use of poison gas by the rebels had just arrived. I mean, it doesn't make a bit of sense that he would have done.
It makes none. And we go back to what Professor Stephen Zuna said. It's all about it's illegal if they're doing it to themselves in another country for us to go in there and get involved.
And here's the article I was talking about. The U.S. has intercepted an order from Iran to militants in Iraq to attack the U.S. embassy and other American interests in Baghdad in the event of a strike on Syria. Military officials have been trying to predict the range of possible responses from Syria, Iran, and their allies all around the world. It said U.S. officials also fear Hezbollah could attack the U.S. embassy in Beirut. And also, Syrian Americans are being interviewed by the FBI. And, you know, they say they're not profiling them, but in fact, they're actually trying, this is what they say, they're trying to say, hey, if you know of anything going bad,
fishy,
let us know. And in fact, I also had a release that I received from, there was a, I think it's happened already, a Syrian American demonstration calling for the bombing. That they, you know, because anybody,
there's always going to be a little.
Well, I think you get the people that have left Syria.
Yes.
That, you know, that suffered so badly under this horrid dictator. You can kind of understand that.
Yeah.
All right, let's get some more calls before our break. Here is Jeanette in Detroit. Jeanette, hi, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I would like to talk about our government and the state of affairs.
Sure.
I feel mortified for everyone that we have to watch on TV children being slaughtered by gas, as in a gas chamber, chemical weapons they used on children. We are, our founding fathers said, one nation under God.
Well, they actually never said that, but go ahead.
Okay. Well, I don't know.
What makes you think they weren't in too big into God?
Yes, they were.
Well, wait a minute.
They were escaping the church.
Yeah, there was.
You know, they didn't want to go back to that.
Two,
being controlled by the church.
There's two foundation documents. One was the Declaration of Independence, and the other was the Constitution. The Constitution makes no reference whatsoever to any supreme being.
Oh, I found a part in there that says a certain part of a government agency cannot stand accountable either way federally. And that is the CIA, who has committed treason against the United States of America. And I am a living testament.
What do you mean you're a living testament?
I own their intelligence equipment for mind control and torture. I am working with a team from the DMC, God bless, receiving the professors at Wayne State.
DMC, the Detroit Medical Center.
Yes.
And so you're torturing people?
Excuse me?
You're torturing people?
No. They created this only for mind control and torture.
Oh, you're not doing that. You're just...
This is real.
Yeah.
No, this is real.
Yeah. Well,
we know that torture happens, right?
Yeah. Well, all right, Jeanette, I have to take a break right now, but I appreciate those remarks. David and the rest of you, stay on the line. A couple open lines. 313, well, here. Let's let the man...
Let him do it.
Let him do it. Yeah, we'll be right back. More about Syria. I want to tell you, if you're just joining us, about a vigil tomorrow in Royal Oak to oppose strikes on Syria. Right back.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Julian Jordan on 101 WRIF. Let your opinion be heard. Call us at 313-298-WRIF.
Whatever's going on, it seems to be far from over.
Peter and Jolene will be taking more of your calls right after this. WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. The Weekend, brought to you by Parkway Chrysler Dodge Jeep Ram on Hall Road, just west of Grosbeck and Clinton Township. Just show up, sign up, and ride. The Riff.
This next song goes out to someone real special. Web developers. You've developed a world wide web of convenience, and Geico.com is eternally grateful. Now everyone can pay bills, manage policies, maybe save big money on car insurance, all from the comfort of their desk chairs, recliners, and water beds. You're magicians with wands made of binary code, and that's why we're sending this next song out to you. For a free rate quote, visit Geico.com.
It's football season at Buffalo Wild Wings, and there's no other place that packs in the action like we do. When there's a timeout during a game, you're watching another game. And when you're not watching that game, you're watching another game. With over 50 big screens, your eyes won't miss any of the action, and neither will your taste buds. You'll enjoy hand-spun wings in 16 signature sauces and 5 seasonings, ultimate nachos, burgers, and over 20 beers on draft. Maybe action-packed is a bit of an understatement.
Buffalo Wild Wings. Wings, beer, sports.
Do you owe the IRS? Do you have unfiled tax returns? Have you received a wage garnishment or bank levy? Maybe a lien has been filed against you. OMG Tax can help you with all your IRS tax problems. Don't wait another second. Take action now. Call my team at OMG Tax. Honest and professional, we don't make false promises. If you owe back taxes or if the IRS is garnishing your paycheck, you need help now. OMG Tax can help you get your life back to normal. If you're serious about handling your tax matter, call OMG Tax now and get the peace of mind you deserve. Don't let the IRS take your next paycheck. Stop waiting and call our team at OMG Tax. OMG Tax has a straightforward, no-nonsense approach and has helped many Americans resolve their IRS nightmare. Call OMG Tax now.
Call 1-800-430-5474. That's 1-800-430-5474. 800-430-5474.
Fun fact of the day. Esurance was built to save you money on car insurance, which is great if you happen to be saving money for a rainy day or a sunny day. Holidays, birthdays, Mondays, Tuesdays, bad days, Wednesdays, good days, Thursdays, Fridays, Saturdays, lazy days, and Sundays. Any days, really. Esurance saves you money on all of them, so have a great day. Esurance. Insurance for the modern world. Now backed by Allstate.
Visit Esurance.com or call 1-800-ESURANCE for a quote. Not available in Allstate. Savings may vary. Allstate products are not available through Esurance.
101 WRIF.
That's perfect.
Everything that rocks.
I'm having trouble trying to sleep. I'm counting sheep but running out. Time ticks by, still I try. No rest for clock stops in my mind. On my own, here we go. My eyes feel like they're gonna bleed. Right up and bulging out my skull. My mouth is dry. My face is numb. Something's falling out in my ribs. On my own, here we go. On an overdrive, the clock is laughing in my face. Crooked spine, my sense is dulled. That's the point of delirium. On my own, here we go.
Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Here are Peter and Julie.
Thank you very much, and welcome back. We're still looking for someone who thinks that we should bomb Syria. You know, it's interesting. In fact, let me get to this first. I was going to read a news report, but Stephen from Farmington Hills writes into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. It is laughable how the warmongering Republican Party under Bush is suddenly a bunch of pacifist isolationists and appeasers.
I know.
It's all about their hatred of Obama, which is True.
I mean, it is true.
Because I was listening to some right-wing station, not the one I usually do, but and this guy was saying, let's humiliate Obama.
Yeah, that's what it's about.
And I was thinking, do we then, like you and I, want to support a bombing of Syria so that Obama doesn't get humiliated? I don't think so. It just is wrong to do it. And people are showing their opposition in many ways all across the United States. Congressmen are reporting they're walking down the street and people are yelling at them, recognize them, and
yeah.
yelling at them, don't bomb Syria. A lot of town hall meetings, people's opposition is right there. And MoveOn.org, big supporter of President Obama, is calling for anti-bombing demonstrations tomorrow. We're still in Sunday. Yeah, tomorrow, 7 o'clock all across the country. You can go to my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com, or our website for Night Call at Facebook.com/Night Call and get all the demonstration. But it's Woodward and 12 Mile Road. And if you go, whoa, I live in Taylor or someplace like that, you know, it's way too far away. Start your own. You can do it. Go to that website. It actually tells you how you can form your own demonstration. And you think, I've never done it before. You can intervene in history. Rather than, I use this phrase sometimes that may sound a little odd, you can be the object of history. In other words, you're just worked upon. The forces of history, the big players, the rich people, the military, all that, they make the decisions and they determine your future, your family, your community, all that, our country. If you're a subject in history, you create history. And you say, me? I'm just one little person that lives in Southgate. What can I do? Well, yeah, things start small. Get some people
That's
together.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely. So, see you tomorrow, some of you at least. Woodward and 12 Mile, 7 o'clock, say no to a strike on Syria. And let's see, I did have that news account. Here's what we're up against, too. That, you read the news. Actually, some of the newspapers aren't so bad. But television looks like it's part of the Obama effort to convince Congress to approve a strike. This from Yahoo News. On Syrian chemical weapons, President Obama's launched a full-court political press rarely seen in Washington. Top administration officials are granting on-air interviews to every broadcast outlet this side of Dubuque. Secretary of State John Kerry is crisscrossing time zone and borders in search of support. Vice President Joe Biden is working the phones in Congress. We've been told that first pets, Bo and Sonny, are lobbying their friends at the dog park.
Oh, God.
The president on Monday will do 6 TV interviews hitting all the major networks and cable news channels. I mean, this is really disgusting.
Yeah.
Because where does the opposition, where do the vast majority of American people that don't want this, how come we don't have our spokespeople on
yeah,
that?
Yeah, we don't. It's just us in the streets.
Yeah. Meanwhile, a couple of administration veterans, former Defense Secretary Robert Gates and former CIA Director David Petraeus, have come out of political retirement to voice support for Obama's plan to attack Syrian targets. Well, what a surprise.
Yeah, shocker.
What a shocker. Yeah. All right, let's get back to some of your calls. What do you think? 313-298-WRIF. Here is David in Detroit. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Hey, Peter. How are you guys doing?
We're good.
Yeah, I'll tell you. Us libertarians are just laughing at all right now.
I think we're having a little
bad connection. He's saying something about us libertarians.
I think we're having a bad connection here. Start again, David. David? Okay. David,
call back.
Yeah, please call back. We can't. Let's see. It says Ron Paul prophetic about Syria back in 2009. So I'd like to hear that. Come on back with that. All right, here is Russell in Fenton. Russell, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Peter.
Hi.
Hi, and hi to Julian also.
Well, hi.
Hi, I was just calling about Syria. I was wondering what you thought about if, no matter what may have happened in Syria, if you think no matter what we might do, might turn into something even bigger than Iraq and Afghanistan?
Well, a lot of times the sky's the limit. I mean, I really don't know what to say. I mean, because there's always the capacity to say, yes, this could wind up to be World War III. I mean, what are we going to do if Russia is supplying armaments to the Assad government? So is Iran. Are we going to bomb them? But I don't know. You're right. You never, this is so open-ended that you can't tell what the consequences are going to be.
Absolutely.
So it's scary.
So let's err on the side of caution and not do it.
Yeah.
I think, yeah, scary is the bottom line here. I believe that.
Well, you know what, Russell, I don't know whether you fit into this category or not, but I'd like to hear what a supporter of President Obama in general would think about the fact that the harm this is going to do him politically. I mean, I couldn't care less. Too bad. I mean, if you know, we got to go kill a lot of people and start a process, as you're saying, that we don't know where it's going to end up to save his political career. I'm not very interested in that, but well, you know.
Yeah, that might even, yeah, I mean, his political career might be over at, you know.
Well, he made a bad decision, that whole thing about a red line and all that. So what's he going to do? He's going to say, well, and it's on some level,
back off.
He is literally damned if he does and damned if he doesn't. And you never, ever, ever want to get in that position. But thank you. Appreciate your call to 313-298-WRIF. Here is David back again from Detroit. Go ahead, David. You're on the air.
I don't know where you cut me off or where I got cut off at.
We couldn't understand you from the start.
Sounded like this.
Well, can you hear me now?
Yeah. I can hear you now.
All right. Well, you know, the point I wanted to make was, and I got to tell you, I had a table at the Dally yesterday for Ron Paul's Campaign for Liberty group, and we weren't there for the Siri issue. We were there against the stop and frisk tactics by the Detroit police. But I was wearing a T-shirt that said, don't blame me, I voted for Ron Paul. And you wouldn't believe, at the Dally, all of the thumbs up that I got from people that just couldn't agree more, that they felt duped into this current president that we have because he's no different than Bush. He's no different than any of them. And the thing is, it's great watching so-called Democrats and so-called Republicans, because to me, we're all the same. We're all people. And they're all coming together singing the anti-war song.
You know,
predicted this. He predicted this 2 years ago during the debates. He said the warmongers would beat the drums and Syria would be next. And here we are.
You know, actually, I stopped by your booth. I was at the Dally in the Alley down by Wayne State University yesterday. What an incredible affair, as always. But one of your perennial candidates were there. I can't think of his name off the top of my head, though.
Well, that was the Libertarian table. That's a whole separate table. You're talking about Scotty Bowman.
Oh, Scotty! Sorry, Scotty, if you're listening. Sometimes he listens. You know, I don't know. Too many people to remember. Yeah. Well,
yeah,
so
no, but,
what are the Libertarians doing? That's what I want to know. It's all right to be, you know, history will prove you right, and apparently it has for Ron Paul. But so you guys got to do something. You going to be out there either independently or join us tomorrow out in Royal Oak?
Absolutely. I mean, we will be there to do whatever we can to get all these people together to realize that it's not us that we should be fighting. We shouldn't be fighting each other. Our enemy is, as it always has been, is government. It's the tyranny of government, because government is out to grow itself. They don't give a damn about you or me, whether you be on the left or on the right. It's all about growing government. So we've got to be united as people and stop with this bickering about the things we don't agree on and start working on the things we do agree on. And that's what I'm trying to do.
All right. That's good. Look for me out there. Look for Jalene. You can see what we look like. In fact, we have some photographs on our Facebook page. I love those photographs. We're down at a demonstration with some mounted police behind us, and we're throwing power, putting our fist in the air like that. All right, I'll look for you tomorrow, David. You look for me. Let's see. Here is Regina from East Point. Regina, hi. You're on the air.
How are you guys?
We're good.
Oh, well, you asked for somebody that is leaning toward the bombing.
Yeah.
And I've been on the fence, and I've been weighing the issue. And I just thought, you know what, for good men to sit aside and do nothing in the face of evil would be wrong. It would be because they are our neighbors. This is a global situation. And they are our neighbors, our friends live in that neighborhood, and you cannot stand by and let this happen.
Well, I mean, part of the problem is, Regina, that it's not all clear what has happened, whether, in fact, the Assad government actually ordered that. There's some.
Well, I heard something about that this evening, like it was the rebels.
Right.
I mean, yes. That's why I'm on the fence about the issue.
Yeah.
Because we're not clear on this. But if it was, I mean, to see these people and what they've gone through.
No, it's horrible. But here's what we have to figure out, Regina. What is going to be accomplished? What's the goal here? They keep talking to some extent about degrading Assad's military forces. Well, will they? You know, think about the bombing of Germany during World War II. The RAF, the British Air Force, and the United States Air Force, they pummeled it. The productive machine, all the factories, and the military bases, obviously, and really didn't do too much. All they really wound up doing was killing lots of German civilians.
Well, you know, they call that whatever. But that's why the U.S. got in, because Churchill neglected to tell them that Pearl Harbor was going to be bombed.
Oh, you think he knew in advance?
He did.
Yeah.
And then he said, well, you know what, we can't do this on our own. We need the U.S. to get into it. And that's when we got into it, the fight against the Nazis.
All right, Regina, thank you very much. Some open lines for you, 313-298-WRIF. In another article, the aforementioned mm-hmm. Stephen Zunas, professor of politics and chair of Middle Eastern Studies at the University of San Francisco, he said he wrote this piece called The U.S. and Chemical Weapons, No Leg to Stand On. And one of the things he says, the first country to use chemical weapons in the Middle East was Great Britain in 1920, because gas was used during World War II, as part of its efforts to put down a rebellion by Iraqi tribesmen when British forces seized the country following the collapse of the Ottoman Empire. According to Winston Churchill, who was one of the more evil politicians of the 20th century, I mean, he's lucky that he had like Hitler and Mussolini and Franco and those guys.
To make him look a little better.
Yeah, or he would have been one of the worst. Pardon me. He said he then was Britain's Secretary of State for War and Air. He said, I do not understand the squeamishness about use of gas. I am strongly in favor of using poisonous gas against uncivilized tribes.
Well...
yikes.
Nice guy.
Yeah. And he didn't finish last, though. So, whatever. All right. Well, there's other subjects to talk about, and I don't want to leave this particularly, but as I said, we're
willing to talk about it if you want to call in.
Yeah, for sure. And I want to keep emphasizing as well, Jalene and I, lots of other people, tomorrow, Monday, 7 p.m., will be at a demonstration on the corner of Woodward and 12 Mile Road to say no to bombing Syria. And if you go to our website, our Facebook page at facebook.com/nightcall, you'll see all the information there. And if you're around anywhere else in the country, if you're around the country anywhere, if you go to that website and you put in your zip code, they'll tell you where the nearest demonstration is. You put in what you want, within 5 miles, within 30 miles,
yeah.
You know, whatever. All right, let's see. Here is Steve. Steve is driving to work. You're on
yep.
the night shift, huh?
I am, yes.
Go ahead, you're on the air.
Well, I was just telling the guy that answered, here's what I don't understand. I've read that there's 100,000 Iraqi civilians or so killed in the bombing the last Iraqi war here,
uh-huh.
and that seems to be a little bit underreported. But now we have 1,400 Syrian civilians that are gassed chemically, and suddenly that seems to warrant a response. So I guess the rule is that you can kill tens of thousands of people with conventional weapons, but as soon as you use chemical weapons, then suddenly, oh, no, none are acceptable.
Well, I mean, that's an interesting point. I mean, one thing is that killing people by conventional means is not against international law or against any of these treaties.
No, it's part of the machine. It's part of the military-industrial complex.
You're right, though, that this one bit of it puts people... I mean, I guess the horrific use of it during World War One, and scarred people. I think it was 1925. There was this Geneva Protocol or something signed that said no country should use them. But it was not against international law to possess them. So any number of countries, including the United States, started stockpiling, and we had this huge stockpile of poison. But the thing is, we were supposed to get rid of them in 2007, and the United States and lots of other countries still has them.
Yeah. I just think there's a certain amount of, I don't know, is it hypocrisy or or irony or whatever. It's, you know, the numbers, as long as they're conventional, you're fine.
So, you got
it's
it.
Kind of a lot of, it's kind of a little all of the above.
Yeah. Steve, thank you so much. I appreciate your call. 313-298-WRIF. Here's Jamie and Frazier. Go ahead, Jamie. You're on
the
air.
Wait.
Oh, sorry. Didn't do my little thing here. Hey, Jamie. Hi. You're on the air.
How are you?
I'm well. Thank you.
Number one, it's never okay to bomb your own people.
Right.
And number two, it's not okay to send our soldiers over there to suck up their bombs.
Yeah.
I mean, these men don't want to go. They're walking in there because our country just that's retarded.
Well, you know, there's two phrases that that really irk me. One is they talk about boots on the ground. That somehow
there will be no boots on the ground.
Yeah, where did that little phrase come from? I mean, then everyone uses it. And what's the other one too? Bad guys. They're the bad guys. Mm. Where did that little juvenile phrase?
Like one politician probably said it. And then
That came out of like old cowboy movies, right? There were the bad guys and the good guys, and I mean, certainly
these are our soldiers. Yeah. These are our homeboys. They don't have to go over there to fight somebody else's war.
Well, yeah, I don't know what we do when there are, say, egregious assaults on people. I mean, I forgot the numbers, but the number of refugees that are coming out of Syria and spilling into Jordan and Lebanon and I think Iraq as well is really destabilizing that whole region. And some of the governments there, like Israel, for instance, they don't want either side to win. I mean, the United States, for instance, in the 1980s, that's not unusual. 1980s, when we were, I want to say not we again, when the United States government had this policy under Reagan of encouraging Iraq to fight Iran, this was this whole idea, have these two people beat the crap out of each other. And we were mostly aiding Iraq, Saddam Hussein. That was the United States' good buddy, Reagan's good buddy at the time. All right, thank you, Jamie. Appreciate your call. And let's see. Here is Yaya in Dearborn Heights.
Hello.
Get your yayas out.
Now, I told Peter that he has to let you finish your thought, Yaya.
Thank you so very much.
Don't count on it.
Okay, just don't copy Peter, please.
Okay.
People don't understand what's going on in Syria. What's going on in Syria is between the Sunnis and the Shias. What people there don't really understand, like who the Sunnis are and who the Shias are. The Sunnis are the followers of the Prophet. The Shias are the followers of the Prophet and his family and his household. So what they're doing right now, the one wants to be better than the other. And what they're doing right now, those people that they're chopping people's head and the ones that they're cutting, shooting the soldiers and doing whatever they're doing, that beating people's hearts and livers and all the stuff, those are the Sunnis. What they're doing right now is that they will stop you and they will ask you, are you Sunni or Shia? There is a different way in how we pray. The Sunnis pray one way. I mean, it's the same way, but it's just different. We, the Shias, do it a little bit different than the Sunnis. And they will ask you, are you Sunni or Shia? And they know that you're lying. And
well, wait a minute. First, you got to ask them, which are you? And then you, whatever they say, you tell them that's what you
the
are.
Because
you don't want to get your liver eaten. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I'm sorry. So, for example, if I tell them that I'm Shia, they will cut my head right there and then. Because I'm not like them. But if I tell them if I'm Sunni and they know that I'm lying, they will ask you the same question like 20 different times. That's what happened with three Iraqi drivers that were driving and they got pulled over and they kept asking them, are you Sunni or Shia? So they told them, no, we're Sunni. Of course they were lying and they were cutting a lie. And you know what happened to them? They got shot in the head.
Well, one of the things that's happening here, there's a secular opposition, and there's also what's happening are these Islamic militants, Al-Qaeda and what have you, going into Syria as well with the idea of setting up an Islamic republic. But that doesn't represent all of the rebel forces, and it's a little difficult to tell who's who, And it's a little difficult to who's got the most effective fighting units and who, if Assad is overthrown, what a new Syria is going to look like. So on one hand, the Israeli government likes to see Assad really off balance and can't be doing any damage to it. On the other hand, it's fearful that a government that would even be more hostile to Israel than Assad. All right, yeah, here's your worst nightmare. We're going to see you. Bye-bye. Thank you.
I met Yaya at Arts Beats and Eats. She's delightful. It was great to meet you, Yaya.
And she complained about me cutting her off like I just did.
But no, you let her go longer than usual, though. I'm working on him.
But that's talk radio, folks. In fact, I've often thought of having the phone screener saying that Peter may end the conversation abruptly.
Oh, Pete, why must you?
Why? Let's talk radio. Here's Joel in Redford. Joel, hi, you're on the air. Hey, Joel, you with us?
Yeah, I'm still here.
What are we still here? You're on the air. Go ahead.
Okay, I was just talking with the other fellow, and I was saying I think something's fishy about it because, there's been all this talk about North Korea wanting to go to war and start a big fight with us. And now all of a sudden, you got this going on, and, it just... It sounds like they're trying to get us involved so they can go to war with us.
Oh, I don't think North Korea wants to go to war with anyone. It's just a lot of posturing.
Well, I don't know. They keep shooting off those nuclear weapons and stuff and keep threatening everybody around them. But,
they've been doing that forever.
It's a lot of
talk. They just like pop in once in a while, throw one of those out, and then... quiet down for a while.
And we got Dennis Rodman over there anyway.
Yeah.
I think he's just been there, wasn't he? I don't know whether he's come back or...
Just again?
Yeah, he said, Kim Jong-un, he said, he's my friend.
Oh, my God. He's out of his mind.
You think? All right, Joel, we got to take a break. Thank you for that. I will consider that. All right, here is our options. You can, right now we have open lines, and we can continue to talk about Syria. But one of the things I want to keep emphasizing, if you really see the dangers of what a military attack on Syria would portend for the United States, the possibility of another open-ended war so that, I wonder how many of you in the audience are like, say, 18, 19, 20, 21, 22. That means that when you were like 12, this war in Afghanistan started something like that. And this could happen again for your like 12-year-old brother. It'd be another 10-year war. Or the other thing, that's the worst case scenario. The best case scenario is the United States goes over there, shoots off a bunch of Tomahawk missiles at $1.5 million a piece.
Oh, my God.
I mean, couldn't somebody make those cheaper? But anyway, they're $1.5 million a piece.
Well, we could send those jobs elsewhere like China. We do everything else. Yeah, why not? God.
So that'll go boom, 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 and then it's over. So that's the best case scenario. And then what will have accomplished? It's certainly, forget about the cost. We're talking about human beings. How many people are going to die in this? How many innocent people? You can say, well, we're going to pinpoint bomb the people that are responsible for this poison gas attack. They have no idea who did it. There's no clear sign that Assad or any of the command structure of the Syrian army called this out. And when you think about this, of how many U.S. wars were just based on total BS?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Most.
Most. Iraq, right? What you think? Think back. Grenada. Where are some of these other things? Panama, the Dominican Republic going on to 1965, Grenada in 1983, Panama in 1989. Vietnam was based on an event that never even occurred.
I was going to say, you're missing a biggie there.
Yeah. World War One, as I always say. Why did we get into World War One? Yeah. Cue the crickets, right? The Mexican War, just a war of aggression, right? The Spanish-American War, based on a fraud saying that the Spanish had blown up a U.S. Destroyer in the Havana Harbor. So we got the odds, like World War II when we were actually attacking. Some people think even that doesn't get into it.
Yeah.
The odds of this being a phony are pretty high. All right. If we don't talk about that, that's up to you. You can call 313-298-WRIF. I want to get back to talking about what we should be talking about, and that's us and our jobs and our economy, and not how the stock market affects Richie Rich Kid, but how it affects us and our communities and all and what have you. All right, right back after these.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Peter and Jolene are taking your calls at 313-298-WRIF.
That's what we do.
We'll be taking more of your calls right after this.
Business owners and professionals face special challenges in divorce court. In addition to everything else going on, they have to contend with allegations that they are earning more than they are, coupled with claims on their business or practices themselves.
Attorney, CPA, Joe Cordell.
An effective defense often hinges on subtle and sophisticated strategies, on things such as business valuations, income allocations, and tax income projections. Clients with assets depend on their divorce lawyer's skills in these matters, and that's why it's so important to hire someone that has those skills.
The domestic litigation firm Cordell & Cordell is the partner men can count on, particularly in the face of complex litigation. Cordell & Cordell, offering sophisticated solutions for men in divorce. 313-465-1999. That's 313-465-1999. Offices in Troy, Novi, and Ann Arbor. 313-465-1999. Or visit online at CordellCordell.com. That's CordellCordell.com.
WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit.
Detroit's new home for Dave and Chuck the Freak is 101 The Riff.
I want to hit the riff. Yeah.
Peter and Jolene, you're listening to Night Call, the Riff award-winning talk show on 101 WRIF.
All right, welcome to our second hour. At 1 a.m., a couple of interesting interviews, and I have to do this by memory. One is with Richard Heinberg, who is writing about fracking and shale oil extraction and the consequences for us on every level. That is, all of a sudden, we're
negative.
Saying, yeah, oh, we've got all this great natural gas. You've seen those ads always on television.
Yeah.
Oh, hey, and oil, we don't have to depend on the Saudis or the Venezuelans.
Yeah, but let's just poison our own water supply.
Yeah, right. So we will talk about that. And, boy, I must have talked to somebody else. But
if I had a working computer over here, I'd be able to help you out there.
I should be able to do this. Wait a minute. Oh, wait a minute. There we go. How come it doesn't do it? Oh, yeah. Here we go. Richard Heinberg, fellow at the Post Carbon Institute. Oh, yeah. This is much better. He wrote a new book called Snake Oil, How Fracking's False Promise Imperils Our Future. And, oh, why am I saying? Peter Kornbluh. Funny, nobody's mentioned this, including us, that we're coming up on September 11th. Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And, but what he is talking about is the other 9/11, which was September 11th, 1973 in Chile, when the United States CIA backed this military coup that overthrew the democratically elected government of that country and installed this fascist military dictatorship that lasted for about 18 or 19 years, torturing people, killing people. Pinochet. Yeah. And it's called, The Pinochet File, a declassified dossier on atrocity and accountability. And he has nailed Henry Kissinger, who is a war criminal of the first order, who is responsible for both in Vietnam and in Chile, of the deaths of tens of thousands of people. And this guy can just go and get probably $30,000-$40,000 for a speech, although he can't go to lots of countries. Because he'll be arrested.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's warrants out for him for war crimes. Did I say about in the last 5 minutes about the vigil to oppose bombing Syria? If not,
no.
Okay. It's going to happen today, Monday, at Woodward and 12 Mile at 7 p.m., 12 Mile Road. I don't know if people say that in other
they
other
don't.
Cities. We say 12 Mile.
Yeah.
Or 8 Mile.
Yeah.
8 Mile's famous. But it's we don't say 12 Mile Road, but that's where it is. 7 o'clock tomorrow. We'll be there, too. All right, here's something on some of our least favorite people. I thought I had another one. But anyway, George Zimmerman's wife is seeking a divorce and also wants him to pay for a life insurance policy with her as a beneficiary for the rest of his life. She said that he was always very angry and abusive. Gee.
Well, this is such a surprise.
Yeah.
And, you know, and they always support him during it. And then some women will be like, okay, you know what? I can't lie anymore.
And our least favorite musician, the wife, well, this is the wife. The wife of rock musician Ted Nugent was arrested a week ago Thursday at Dallas-Fort Worth International Airport after a gun was found in her carry-on luggage.
Like, why do people do this?
Well, she said she didn't remember and...
You have to actually place it in your luggage somehow.
Yeah. Shemaine Ann Nugent, 51, was taken into custody, and her attorney said... Nugent completely forgot or never knew the weapon was in her bag. Gee, how did that big Glock get in my bag?
A gun. I mean, I know when I pack, I know everything that's in there.
You don't pack your Glock?
I usually leave. I try to leave it at home most times.
By the way, you can put it in your checked luggage.
I know.
That's all right. She has a permit to carry a concealed weapon. The airport, and there's something about the South. The airport ranks second behind Hartsfield-Jackson Atlanta International Airport for guns found in carry-on luggage. According to TSA spokesman, let's see, more than 1,000 guns have been found this year in airports nationwide. People that are bringing them out. And finally, for Lee's favorite, I guess the Lord doesn't like his ass no more because Tim Tebow has been released by the New England Patriots. And I guess maybe he might get picked up. He got sacked, and he was sacked 4 times in 3 of the Patriots' 4 preseason games.
Now,
so,
what's up with that?
I don't know. That's what I said. Maybe.
God isn't on his side.
Yeah, wow. That was weird to do. All right. A little bit about the economy, right? There's a recovery for the economy. That is to say, if you look at the stock market, it's gone above 15,000 a couple of times. The millionaires are making more millions. The billionaires are making more billions. And there's unemployment has gone down a little. Many people think that if you include people that have given up looking for work and that are working part-time and are working beneath the pay grade that they were fired from, that we're talking 13-14%.
Yeah, well, and that trend toward part-time work is huge.
Yeah, and one of the things, a lot of these employers are using Obamacare to push people back to part-time.
As an excuse.
Yeah, they say, oh, you got to work, if you work 30 hours or more, that commie, we have to provide health insurance. We're going to cut people back to 29 hours.
Jeez.
Oh, horrible.
That is just awful.
Well, everybody's not taking this lying down. One of the richer firms in the world is also the biggest retailer in the world, Walmart. And there were these protests this week. Walmart workers and supporters, launched protests in at least 15 cities on Thursday, urging the world's largest retailer that they provide higher wages, better jobs, and the right to unionize.
Huh. Yeah, good luck.
Yeah, good luck. I need my billions. The family, the five richest, the five kids of Sam Walton are worth something like a total of $120 billion. That's like the national economy of some countries around the world. But they earned it. Well, they didn't earn it at all. They inherited. They didn't do a damn bit of work ever. One of the women, I always forget her name, she's opened up some multi-million-dollar art museum down in Arkansas. And let's see, where is... Okay, there's something called OUR, O-U-R. I forgot what it stands for. Our Walmart, a coalition including Walmart workers, community organizers, and the United Food and Commercial Workers, organize these day-long protests, urging Walmart to pay full-time wages of $25,000 a year. Now, there's some of you who are probably out there would think, man, I'm for them. I would love to make $25,000. Think of you, though, some of you that are making $50,000, $60,000, $70,000 a year, which puts you probably in the 65th percentile or something like that. And think if you had to raise your family on that. They want $12 an hour.
Yeah. And it's not that easy to live on that.
No.
Especially if you're a family. But I was just having this conversation with a coworker earlier today who said, you know, I used to make, it was about like 23 grand. And she's like, it was tough.
Yeah. Yeah. The Walmart has 1.3 million workers, who they call associates, many of them are part-time employees, averaging $8.80 an hour. Now, you know, it's all about distribution of wealth that's created. How do you do it? I mean, if you pay people a decent wage of $15 an hour, particularly when you have a company that's so wealthy, there's less money for the company, right? Less money for the stockholders. So they're fighting to keep out unions because, gee, what would those awful unions do?
Wait, help the employees?
Yeah, and get them more money.
Yeah.
So the money has to go somewhere. And the way it is now, it's all going to the people that already have it. They would like to, where is this? The Walmart protests, which followed last week's broader widespread strikes among fast food industry workers seeking $15 an hour wages from the fast food chains, were scheduled for Los Angeles, San Francisco, New York, all over the country, including Detroit, where Walmart is threatening to cut expansion if it's required to pay a city-mandated living wage of $12.50 an hour. These son of a bitches.
I know, they really are. And with this movement that's been going on with the fast food workers, I've heard people criticizing them and saying, well, all you do is flip burgers. And it's like, you know what? Why don't you go do that for a day? It's not necessarily enjoyable, and it is hard work. You're on your feet all day, and it's thankless,
yeah.
And especially when so many people in the population look down upon people who work in fast food, whereas oftentimes that's the only thing people can get for a job right now.
And somebody's got to do it.
I mean, I don't, you know, I'm not a huge fast food consumer by any means, but
I want slow food.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, these are these people's livelihoods.
You know, I can't find this. I thought there was in this article. The CEO of Walmart makes $20 million a year.
$20
million. Yeah, yeah. And some of these people, when we get, I mean, these guys don't have employees, but these are hedge fund managers. David Tepper from Appaloosa Management, he made $2.2 billion in 2012. Raymond Dalio from Bridgewater Associates, $1.7
billion. Oh, my God.
Stephen Cohn, I think he's having some trouble with the law, though. SAC Capital Advisors, $1.4 billion. And they're talking about not wanting to pay our neighbors
$12 an hour.
$12 an hour. They want to pay him $8.80. So, I mean, imagine this, that it really, and I don't think it would, really kind of cut into the kind of compensation they could give to their, Walmart could give to their upper echelon people. Maybe the CEO, and I don't know why this is, I know I just saw this tonight, that he might only have to take a paltry, say, $2-3 million a year income. So I know what, because somewhere in this article it said that he makes something like $9,750 an hour.
What?
Yeah. Yeah.
I guess when you break it down.
Yeah.
Wow.
The people that are providing
him. How greedy is this guy?
The people that are providing him with the money, and he's not necessary. There could be, say, what they used to, what are called workers' councils, that people could, on the shop floor, or on the store floor in this case, get together democratically, elect representatives that could go up to a higher council, and that could be the decision-making body. Do you really think they could do any worse than a single guy that's, you know, this great big hotshot? I don't think so.
Right, and how about having happy workers who can feed their family?
And by the way, you and I mean that, not the government, but we are subsidizing this CEO making $20 million, because the last time I was on, I was saying, they make so little, the so-called associates. That's such a disgusting
word. I know, it is.
Because it's trying to disguise that, in fact, they're just exploited workers. They don't make enough money to, and they don't get health care, so they get on Medicaid. Medicaid, and we're paying for it. So we are subsidizing the stock.
Walmart's workers.
We're subsidizing the Walmart owners.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's go back to our phones, and let's pick up Jim. Jim's list. Talk about the South. He's down in Birmingham, Alabama. Hey, thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. You're on the air.
It's a pleasure to talk to you, Peter, and it's been a long time since I talked to you. Used to talk to you when you were broadcasting nationally, and it's just a pleasure. You guys.
I remember you.
Yeah, me too. Yeah.
Yeah, it's been a while because I was drummed off radio here in Birmingham, and since then I've been blackballed and really attacked left, right, and sideways. But I'm a big boy here, and I can take all the everything they can dish out.
There you go.
I want to say this. I'm calling in concern to you talk about weapons of mass destruction and weapons of mass deception. We have Ms. Condoleezza Rice who's coming to Birmingham to tell us about the so-called bombing at 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham.
Oh.
And most of us, a lot of us in this community, including all of those who protested back during the Civil Rights Movement, think she's trying to pull out the biggest fraud since she's talked about the mushroom cloud would occur if we did not attack Iraq. It was a big lie. She knew it was a lie. And this lady has lied and defrauded the American people all the way up to Secretary of State.
Sure. Wait a minute, Jim. Let me go back. She is coming to Birmingham, Alabama, to talk about what happened in Birmingham in the 1950s, the bombing of those churches where those poor little girls were killed and the cops turned hoses and dogs on people.
Yes. Miss Rice, who left Birmingham, in her autobiography, she says she left Birmingham at 12 years of age. She actually left when she was 9 because her daddy was so disgruntled at the civil rights movement until he told his wife and his daughter, I'm getting the hell out of town. I despise Shuttlesworth. I despise Dr. King. And they got out of town.
You know, I read this thing that said the day that all of this, the civil rights movement came down, when it came to a head there and those big, you know, they turned the hoses on everybody, she was taking a tennis lesson. Look that up.
She wasn't allowed to play with most of the kids in the neighborhood. She was skipped she didn't ever have first grade. She was skipped. Her mother was a teacher. Her daddy was a teacher and a preacher. And her mother tutored her, and she, you know, filled out some forms for her, take tests, and then she moved up to the third grade, starting off in school. But she didn't stay in school in Birmingham no longer than in Birmingham schools no longer than about a year or so. And after the civil rights movement started, her daddy got out of town.
Yeah, and as you said, her father, who was a minister, opposed Martin Luther King Jr. and also opposed the civil rights movement itself. Well, Jim, it's good to have you back. I appreciate your comments, and call us again.
Okay, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Good to talk to you.
Boy, why do I get the cough tonight?
I don't know. I think there's a lot of allergies going around. I know a lot of people who are going through it right now.
All right, let's return to Syria. Here's Randy in Westland. Randy, thanks for bringing Syria back to our attention. You're on the air. Hi.
How are you doing?
Good.
I don't know if many people are aware of the world reserve currency being the U.S. dollar.
Sure.
So
I don't know whether people are, but yeah, it is.
Well, you probably are, though, right?
Yeah, right.
Okay, well, basically, by the world reserve currency being the U.S. dollar, and what's going on is Iran is selling oil to Russia and China in their currency, which is what Saddam Hussein was doing and Gaddafi was doing. And when they both started to not use the dollar, then they all of a sudden were an issue, and we had to get rid of those guys. We didn't have to get rid of Saddam the first time, because God forbid there would be a power vacuum. But when he started taking the euro instead of the dollar, then all of a sudden he had weapons of mass destruction. And same thing with Gaddafi. All of a sudden, rebels were rising up against him because he was not taking the U.S. dollar. He was creating his own currency and trying to start a North African Union. So now you have Iran doing the same thing, and it's kind of a mafia tactic. What does the mafia do when you cut them out of their percentage, when you're supposed to be paying them payola or profit, you know, you pay your protection every week? They throw a firebomb through your storefront window. Syria is Iran's storefront window.
Well, I don't know that, let me just tell people this reserve currency, what you're talking about. This is countries all around the world have significant holdings of U.S. dollars. That is their reserve currency, and an international trade, you know, is pegged to the dollar and what have you. But, yeah, I would almost, well, I was going to say China would be probably more of a, you know, a rival for that. But they don't want to undermine the U.S. currency because, you know, they have so much invested. And I don't think it's that simple. I think that did happen, and that could have been what sealed Saddam's fate. But it certainly is an element. I wouldn't dispute that.
One of the countries at the head of the line of people of countries that want to replace the U.S. dollar with another currency that is made up of a combination of, you know, 5% of this currency, 5% of that currency, and they want to replace the U.S. dollar because they're sick of the Federal Reserve just printing money and devaluing the dollar.
Well, it is, we're at a critical point here, and there's not much being done internationally that's creative. In other words, we're talking about degrading Syria's military. The whole international exchange and monetary system and the dollar and all that, that's what's being degraded. It was attempting, you know, when it got off the gold standard, when, you know, the stuff that that they decided at after World War II, that worked for a while. There's going to have to be, something else come along, or this is just going to keep not just being repeated. It's going to get worse and worse. All right, Randy, thank you very much for calling in. I appreciate it. And 313-298-WRIF is our phone number. Here's Mike in Roseville. Hey, Mike, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, Pete. Jolene.
Hi.
Hello.
Hi,
you guys. I'm a longtime listener.
Yeah, good.
Good.
I just turned you guys in, and I was
turned. You turned us in.
What did we do?
You turned us on. You turned us on. Oh, I thought you meant you turned us in. All right, go.
Nah,
there's a difference.
Yeah. I'm sorry about that.
Yeah,
no, I just.
I'd rather
just
you turned
home
us on.
Here, and I was on my way home, and I heard Walmart workers are complaining about $8.80 an hour.
Yeah.
Man, that's a decent wage. You got to be kidding me. I would love to make that.
You make
I'm
less.
I'm not making that right now, and I'm struggling. You know, I make minimum wage. I make $7.50 an hour, and I would love to make $8.80 an hour.
But wouldn't you rather make $12 an hour, $15 an hour?
Oh yeah, I definitely would. But
that's what we're fighting for here.
Yeah, I can't see how anybody complain about that. I mean,
well, you should complain mightily. They should complain mightily, and people that believe in supporting their neighbors and their community should protest mightily as well. I mean, for one thing, if you got a raise, and you're talking about when these fast food workers are demanding a raise to $15 an hour, so literally your salary would be doubled. And what would you do with that extra money? You'd spend it, right?
Well, no, I'd just make my bills.
I mean.
I mean, maybe I could buy a car. I don't even have a car. I ride a bike to work. So
point right there.
Yeah, that's what I mean. That there is an accelerator effect when wages go up. I mean, the conservatives are always saying, well, you know, you'll just cause inflation and what have you. I mean, there is some because the owners don't want to take less of a, less of have less money come into them, and they want to make sure they get the money. Employees get as little as possible. But what happens as soon as people get raises, they start spending, particularly at the lower end of the economic spectrum. If you're a multimillionaire already, you got somebody like the CEO from Walmart we were talking about, and he makes $20 million a year and he gets $2 million raise, it's not like he's going to go, oh, I can go buy now, because he's bought everything. He has everything. There's not even the slightest point to him getting any more money, the fact that there are billionaires, it's not like they spend it. They can't. You can't spend billions. You can't spend millions.
But it's that whole greed thing. Once you make a bunch of money, it's like you more. It's like a drug.
Yeah, I don't think it's not greed in the sense that they want more money to get more stuff, because they have all the stuff. It's almost they want to be the richest person in the country, or it's a sign of prestige.
Yeah, sure.
I mean, think about this, Mike. If somebody was, say, some of these guys I was talking about earlier, that these financiers that make $1.7 billion a year, $1.7 billion a year, if he gave away 95% of his money, he would still be richer than anybody that you and I know, right?
Well, If I could make $8 an hour, I'd take it.
Okay.
Man.
All right, but you got to fight for it.
You got to fight. This, right, this is what we're talking about. Yeah. You shouldn't be wanting $8 money. You should be getting. You deserve a lot more.
Well, there was, I'm trying to remember American history, it was a fair day's wage for a fair day's work. And that's what it was. I can't remember who said that.
I should ask him what he does. He probably works his butt off.
Yeah, of course. Because those are disvalued jobs and...
In the eyes of some people.
In the eyes of employers, because... Yeah, it's supply and demand. If there's a lot of people that will work for $7.50 an hour, $7.75 an hour, well, then that's what they'll pay. I'm looking at this article now. Over 100 economists agree raise the minimum wage to $10.50 an hour. That's so inadequate. And maybe some of you...
Maybe we need to start somewhere, though.
And maybe there's some of you that are small retailers. You say, man, I can't afford to pay people $10.50, let alone $12.50 or $15 an hour. Hey, Australia, I think the minimum wage is
16 or 17, isn't it?
And somewhere way up there, yeah. And they're one of the few countries that didn't go through the world recession.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So maybe let's study that a little bit.
Yeah, right. And so people that are beginning to organize, to get together, because you can't do anything by yourself. You can be like our last caller and hope, and just hope that somehow or other you'll get more money. But why should they? Because if they give you $8 an hour, as you were indicating would be quite a would be a raise, well, then they have to give it to everybody else. And if people want $8 an hour, soon they'll want $9 an hour.
Those greedy people, huh?
You know,
yeah, God.
Contrary to what a lot of you may think, Jalene and I don't make a fortune. The fortunes at least in radio, aren't what they used to be. They're still possible. I mean, it's still possible.
We're not living in mansions.
Yeah.
But the thing is, even if we had all that money, we still wouldn't live in mansions.
Yeah.
We're pretty simple people.
My wife and I went out to breakfast today, and let me see. I think it was like breakfast wound up to be $32.
For two people?
Yeah.
Wow.
I mean, I know. You can go like to the Hilton Road Cafe, and it would have been about 12 or 14. We went to this nice place called O'Mara's in Berkeley. And there was omelets and frittatas. Oh, doesn't that sound swank?
It does.
For $10 a piece, that's 20. Coffee, $2.50 a cup.
Yeah.
That's 25. 20% tip, that's 30. And, and I forgot about tax. Yeah.
Not cheap.
All right. No. So, I mean, it was some special occasion.
I hope it was delicious.
It was absolutely really good.
Okay, good.
And more than, omelets now, they're like...
size of your head.
Yeah, they are. But like an 8 omelet.
We call those U.S. portion sizes.
I was mentioning a fair day's work for a fair day's pay. And John, who's taking your calls at 313-298-WRIF, says, that was that Franklin Delano Roosevelt in a New Deal speech? No, I don't think so. Come on, you got the Google there. Or did Charles Dickens say fair day's pay?
Ah.
I don't think so. All right, let's take another call before our break, but get in on this conversation, this and about Syria. Here's Rick in East Point. Rick, hi, it's Peter and Jalene. You're on the air.
Yes, it's first time calling.
Oh, welcome.
You're not the first time caller, Rick. Are you?
No, first time ever calling this station.
Really? I thought because there's somebody that we call...
But this guy, that's a different Rick in East
Point. It's a different Rick in East Point. Sorry.
Yeah, there's another one. Go figure. Well, welcome.
Welcome, yes.
Well, I was just trying to join the topic. I was trying to say that even though I'm all for people making more money, but shouldn't we fight for inflation to go down? Because if you pay people higher wages, inflation is going to kick in. You're still going to come out the same.
You know, Rick, that's a commonly made argument, and I hate to say it, but it's usually the one that the employers and the Chamber of Commerce make, and it's really not the case. I mean, in fact, I said just a little earlier, there's a tendency for some of it to go up because people will raise prices. But, you know, there's been steady inflation since forever because, used to be you get a steak dinner for $1.75, but now it's, what have you. But I'm going to take a break. And, I'm glad you brought that up because it's a commonly held perception. But let me look for some stuff and I'll comment on it when I come back, okay?
Okay.
All right.
Thanks for calling for
Rick number
time.
Two. Yes, from East Point. I appreciate it. Thank you very much. What did we used to call? Was it Ron Paul
he
Rick?
He was Ron Paul Rick.
Yeah. But
then he took his Ron Paul shirt off.
Yeah,
remember?
He got just discouraged. I don't even think he listens anymore.
I don't know.
Yeah.
He fell off.
Peter and Jolene DeRick, are you out there? All right. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Let your opinion be heard. Call us at 313-298-WRIF.
Whatever's going on, it seems to be far from over.
Peter and Jolene will be taking more of your calls right after this.
Attorney CPA Joe Cordell.
Divorce is never an easy decision, nor should it be. You didn't get married to get divorced, and if your thinking is right, you won't choose divorce when good alternatives exist. Having said that, if you're a man facing divorce, you should know that, like many things in life, timing is important. Too often guys find themselves in a divorce court when their businesses are thriving, when their investments are appreciating, and their income soaring. Not surprisingly, these conditions tend to produce more painful property divisions and richer support orders. The reverse is typically true when men are in less favorable financial circumstances, when their assets and their ability to pay are diminished. My point is simply this. Divorce may make the most sense for men when they can least afford it. Think about it.
Call the domestic litigation firm of Cordell & Cordell, a partner men can count on. Offices in Troy, Novi, and Ann Arbor, 313-465-1999. That's 313-465-1999. Or visit online at CordellCordell.com. That's CordellCordell.com.
Hello?
Hi, I'm calling about the two-bedroom apartment you advertised. Is it still available?
Sure.
Great.
Unless you're black or Latino or disabled.
Housing discrimination is rarely this obvious, but it's just as real and just as illegal. So if you hear things like,
I can't assign you a handicapped parking space.
That could be housing discrimination. And the only way to stop it is to report it so we can investigate it. Visit hud.gov/fairhousing or call HUD's housing discrimination hotline at 1-800-669-9777. A message from HUD in partnership with the National Fair Housing Alliance.
Attention business owners, this is Tony Robbins. I've spent the last 3 decades helping companies create serious business breakthroughs, and I want to help you like never before.
And this is Chet Holmes, author of the #1 business book, The Ultimate Sales Machine. If you've heard my radio spots before, maybe you don't know that about 2,000 action-oriented business owners call us every week to get our free reports. But it was Tony Robbins that challenged me to go even further for you.
Chet and I have built a serious training program called 4 Ways to Double Sales in 12 Months.
And here's what Tony convinced me to do.
We're going to give this to any business owner who calls us at 800-936-0222. Just call with your email address, and we'll email you this phenomenal audio training program at our expense, not yours.
It's a heck of a gift. See if you agree. 4 Ways to Double Sales in 12 Months.
Call and leave us a voicemail with your email, and we'll give you a program that others have paid dearly to receive. Call right now. That's 1-800-936-0222.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan.
And it is our final segment, so grab those phones if you have something to say, and we'll get you on the air. At 1 a.m., I'm going to be playing an interview with Richard Heinberg. He's mostly known for his work on what's called peak oil, P-E-A-K, peak oil. The fact that we have drained our reserves to the point where that we're on the downside. And so we're more than half over what we need for oil. And he is what they call a fellow, you know. I don't know. It's kind of a title. At the Post Carbon Institute, he said, we got to get off carbon energy completely. Also, Peter Kornbluh talking about the other September 11th, 1973, the U.S. CIA overthrew a democratically elected government in Chile and ushered in 18 years of fascist dictatorship, military dictatorship under a general named Pinochet. I can't think of why am I losing it tonight? I can't. Of course, I say that a lot, don't I? Maybe it's not tonight. Augusto. Yeah, see,
Augusto,
all right, I got
Pinochet.
It. I still got it.
You
yeah.
did it. Can you say Ahmadinejad tonight?
Yeah, Ahmadinejad. All right, there you go. He's gone.
I know.
Yeah, he used to be the big. Anyway, he's talking about the other 9/11, the 1973 CIA-backed coup in Chile that overthrew an elected government and installed a military dictatorship.
Well, and it was a deadly dictatorship.
Torture, repression, everything you could imagine, including this awful treatment of prisoners when they first rounded up, and attacking a famous folk singer, Victor Jara, J-A-R-A.
And women and children.
Well, yeah, but he was... you know what? Listen, we talk about that.
Yeah, I don't think I know that one.
Yeah, it's an incredible story that how these...
I'm back on the air at 9 a.m., so I will not be able to listen. Okay. I'll have to listen to the podcast.
All right, indeed. And we'll have a podcast up today at noon. All right, let's go to some emails here as well. This is from Briggs. Briggs writes, "Hey, Peter and Jolene, wanted to pass along this article. Just got to say it's kind of bizarre watching the Republicans act like they are anti-war.
Yeah.
Even Tea Party Republican Candace Miller has a letter in the Free Press this week claiming to be anti-war." Well, I said right at the beginning of the program, there was this politician that wrote me talking about how we had to stand together to stop this unconstitutional attack on Syria. And I wrote her back, hey, welcome to the anti-war movement.
I love that.
Yeah, right.
We will be at 12 in Woodward, by the way, tomorrow, 12 Mile Woodward in Royal Oak. That's Royal Oak, right?
Yes.
And at 7 p.m., and we will be saying no war in Syria. So join us.
Yeah.
Or tonight, actually, Monday night.
Winston Smith writes in, most Walmart employees, we were talking about Walmart, receive food stamps and other forms of federal assistance, which means the taxpayers ultimately supplement Walmart's payroll.
That's what we said.
And remember, don't blame it on the Walmart workers.
Yeah, blame it on...
Yeah.
The
big Jesus. Let's see. This one's too long for me to... this is from Sam, who writes in the calltalkyes@yahoo.com. He says, I see no point in, this is just the second paragraph, cutting Obama off at the knees when he still has 3 years to effect change for the better in this country, at least relative to the agenda of the right. Why needlessly let the petty, hypocritical Republicans score any hits on Obama? Which is one of the arguments, sort of an internal Democratic Party argument, that we are going to be, if Obama loses through popular, imagine that, by popular pressure, by the people actually saying no to an imperial president, something we should have done with, six others and six other wars that were unnecessary the United States fought. Actually, it's probably more than that. But that somehow this is going to cut him off at the knees. You know what that would be? Power to the people.
Yeah.
What a concept. Sam, I'm going to read the rest of your message later when I can do that. Let's see. Okay. Thanks to Jerry, who writes in the call, talkyes@yahoo.com, that $8.80 an hour that the one caller said. But think about this, Jerry. The guy, that would be $1.30 an hour increase. I know, that doesn't even buy you a cup of coffee. The one that I had for breakfast. I'm not going back to that place anyway. $2.50 for a cup of coffee. Anyway, he did the math, and it comes out to $18,304 a year, $8.80. And he said, it's a shame people are drooling to get a wage that is still $2,000 below the official poverty level. Indeed.
Yes, yes, yes.
Yeah. All right. Let's go to, Reverend Shortcut. Reverend Shortcut, you are on the air. Thanks for calling.
How you doing, Mr. Werby?
I'm well.
I'm standing at a Myers right now outside in Washington Township on 26 and Van Dyke.
Yeah.
I'm right at the Octagon House, between the Octagon House and the Myers. It's freezing out here.
Peter talks about the Octagon House all the time.
I've been out to the Octagon House.
Beautiful house.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'd like to tell people one thing.
Wait. How many sides? How many sides does that house have?
Oh, God, 12?
Hey, Reverend Shortcut, octagon means eight.
Oh, I don't know. I just woke up out of a dead sleep.
Wait, let me tell you something real quickly. There's a friend of mine that works on a publication in New York called the Monthly Review.
Yeah.
So I was on the phone talking to him, and I said, how many times, how often does the publication come out?
Oh, God.
And he said, Peter.
It's
think of the title.
Review.
Yeah. All right. Okay. Go ahead. So you just woke up. You're outside. What are you doing outside?
Well, I went power walking.
Oh, okay.
Oh.
With my dog. I took my dog out for power walk.
A little midnight power walk. I like it.
And what I'd like to say is that what people don't realize is years ago, Myers, Walmart, Kmart, I remember the old Kresge many years ago,
yeah,
before it became Kmart. These were jobs of McDonald's, Burger King. These were jobs that were part-timers. They were adding a few dollars to the family. Today, since things have changed and all the manufacturing jobs are gone, these jobs are mainline jobs
yep.
for the family.
That's sure. right.
And they don't need $50 an hour. They need $20, $25 an hour. And if you study it properly, you'll find out that the corporation's naturally being greedy. They don't want to pay it. So they're going to tell you it's going to cost you $12 for a burger. But that's an absolute lie.
Yeah.
They'd have to raise a burger about 15 cents to pay that wage, $15. 15 cents. And I'm willing to pay it.
Well, and they don't even have to do it. They just have to take less return on their investment. Because why should they be allowed to erode the wage that people deserve? You know, here, I haven't heard this in a long time. People say this is the greatest country in the world. Why do we have the worst and the lowest minimum wage of any country in the industrialized world? I mean, if we're the greatest country in the world, we're the richest country
in the
world. And the
only one without a national health care system, which we kind of do, but...
To boot, yeah.
Money for everybody.
Okay, I love it.
We're with you.
Reverend Shortcut, come on in out of the cold. All right, talk to you later. Here, Robert Pollan and Jeanette Wicks-Lim where are we doing here? They've said today, over 100 professional, this is a little while ago, a couple months ago, over 100 professional economists have signed a petition in support of House Bill 1346, which is catching up to the 1968 Act of 2013. Now, I don't know if that makes sense. The act sponsored by I used to think it was John Conyers was the best congressman in the House of Representatives.
Yeah.
But Congressman Alan Grayson of Florida is right there. He is absolutely incredible.
Well, Florida needs him.
And he says this would raise the federal minimum wage from its current level of $7.25 to $10.50. So he's not really up there, but, you know, it's still good. The approximate level it would have been if the 1968 minimum wage had kept up with inflation.
Oh, my gosh.
So inflation, and this is, who was it? Was it Rick in East Point? Which I couldn't find the exact thing I was looking for. But what this says is that inflation went ahead and it had nothing to do with wages rising because wages didn't rise. And in fact, what has happened is that there's been a fall behind for ordinary working people, particularly the lower end of the income scale. The petition, signed by economists from dozens of universities and research institutes, explains how a minimum wage employee working full-time at the current rate earns $15,000 a year, almost 20% below the poverty line for a family of three. I mean, that's impossible. I mean, do you think one person could live in the suburbs, say in Royal Oak? Impossible.
Yeah.
Renting, there's probably in Ferndale, there's probably places that are...
You'd have to have many roommates.
$600 mm-hmm. bucks a month.
That's tough to find.
Yeah, but there are some in Ferndale, and particularly in Ferndale. Right. And have a card so you can get to your work and all that.
Pay your $15,000
and have two other people you're supporting? I don't think so.
No.
Yeah, so these figures, you're probably talking about $35,000. So they're $20,000 under what should be a living wage. Okay. All right. That's good. All right. Want to get on to this, too. The Supreme Court in Massachusetts, the Supreme Judicial Court, will begin hearing arguments this week in an atheist Acton. Acton's a town. Couple's request to strike the words "under God" from the Pledge of Allegiance that their children say in the Acton-Boxborough Regional School District. Now, the couple's suit filed anonymously. Now, why in the world would they have to file it anonymously? I was going to say, maybe they're ashamed. No, they're afraid of religious nuts. Because so much of the violence in the world, whether you're, whatever it is, Hindu, Islam, Judaism, Christianity,
mm-hmm.
you go against their religion, you know, they say, you know, you're going against the word of God, you have to be killed.
Yeah.
I mean, here's...
I can't believe how much attention atheism is getting in the last couple of years.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Why?
And it hasn't gone away.
You know, the first...
reason for that.
Not the First Amendment. What are those things? The commandments. The first commandment, thou shalt have no other God. I am a jealous God. Why would the master of the universe be jealous? Why would he have such a petty emotion?
Yeah, it just doesn't go with the you know, the whole golden rule.
Oh, Peter and Jolene don't believe in me. I give up flying. Right? Why would he care? I must be worshipped.
My Christian friends, Peter, they all tell me that Jesus loves me.
Well, and that should be whether we even...
Well, no matter what I am.
Yeah, no matter whether we acknowledge his existence or his divinity or not. I mean, if it's true love.
Yeah.
I mean,
unconditional.
I'm not going to love you unless you worship me.
The only unconditional love there is from your dog.
Right. I say that to the women in my life. You must worship me, or I will not love you.
I know. I'm used to it.
Damn. Right. So here's the deal. So this couple who, out of fear of these religious nuts, have to file this suit anonymously and hide. On behalf of their three children, they're saying, why are they saying this religious prayer, which turns out to be, rather than a statement of patriotism, which we could talk about that.
Mm-hmm.
But Eric Rosbeck, who is the deputy general counsel of something called the Beckett Fund for Religious Liberty, he says you're going to be taking away the liberty of kids that want to say it. Do you think kids want to say it at all? Do you think they care?
No, I don't. I remember you're like, here we go, I was a kid.
They want to hear the bell ring.
Yes.
To get their butt out to the playground.
It's lunchtime or school's over.
And usually this kind of suit is filed by the Freedom From Religion Foundation, the FFRF.org. But this is the Old American Humanist Association. Now, let's see. Middlesex Superior Court Judge Jane Haggerty rejected the lawsuit last year, ruling that under God does not convert the exercise into a prayer. Well, why would you think just because you're invoking a deity that would transform it into a prayer? So that the children can choose not to say the pledge and that the inclusion of under God did not violate the children's rights. Now, what we're talking about here is a separation of church and state. Now, how in the world did this get into it? We've talked about this some before.
Oh, yeah.
The pledge was devised by a Christian minister who was also a socialist, Christian socialist. There were a lot of them back there in the 1890s and still some today.
Oh, back in those good old 1890s.
Been the gay 90s, as we used to call it. But it meant something different then. But anyway, Congress added the phrase under God to the pledge in 1954. Now, who in the world could have wanted that there? Remember we said it was to distinguish us from the godless communists, right?
Yeah.
But the two main forces behind this were the Catholic Knights of Columbus and Billy Graham.
Oh, gosh, I always forget that Billy Graham.
Yeah, and specifically... Graham said that we need this to demonstrate that we are a Christian nation.
God, he has been a menace for that long.
Yeah, and this, of course, is not a Christian nation. It is a secular nation.
Thank you.
That respects all religions.
I know. I saw something. I know it sounds really ridiculous, but a few people posted something about, does anyone know about this Fox News anchor who was chastising atheists the other day?
No.
She was going off on us.
I love it.
I know. She's talking about us.
P.T. Barnum said, any publicity is good publicity as long as they spell your name right.
And they never spell my name right, but I don't care.
Oh, your personal name.
Yeah.
Yeah, people don't. But, yeah, you know, remember, and we talked about this, you know who really gave a kick in the butt to atheism was George W. Bush and all those right-wing Christians.
Mm-hmm.
People said, wow, if this is Christianity.
I don't want to be.
Yeah.
It's like if loving you is wrong, I don't want to be right.
Here's a couple of interesting Christians, you know, and I'm sure, you know, there's some bad atheists in history. We don't even mention them.
We're good ones.
Yeah, we're good. Well, there's some good Christians. We know
them all. Of course,
And in fact, many of the good Christians that I know, and good Muslims, and good Jews, are going, are we missing anybody? Hindus and all those people. They're going to be at Buddhists. Yeah, they're going to be at the demonstration today in Royal Oak, 7 p.m. tonight, Monday, to say no to the bombing of Syria.
12 Mile and Woodward.
12 Mile and Woodward at the Shrine of the Little Flower.
We're going to church again, Peter.
We're going to church. Here's a couple of good Christians. A Christian radio host told his listeners this week he had no problem with attending gay weddings. We say, oh, hey, a right winger.
I know. The first, when I read the headline, I thought, wow, this is amazing.
As long as the same-sex couples were told that they had committed an abomination, and they shall both be put to death.
Put to death. This guy's out of his mind.
Yeah, and think about this. A loving couple who has a relationship that you might, as a religious person, not approve of.
Or you might be uncomfortable with.
Uncomfortable with. But here are these guys threatening death.
These people are sick in the head, truly.
Yeah.
And that's why they make the headlines. Do you think they do it to make the headlines?
Well, maybe a talk show host does. We got to do something to make some headlines.
We haven't done that lately.
And he kept talking, this talk show host, whose name I don't want to give him any publicity, kept talking about neuronic weddings. Neuronic? What the hell is neuronic? And it's about Nero, you know, the emperor of Rome, who supposedly fiddled while Rome burned. You never heard that phrase?
Yes.
Yeah. And he had orgies and all that.
Oh,
and he carried
sounded
on.
Like a good time.
Yeah, well, it wasn't too good for Rome. Because the barbarians were at the gate. The Vandals. That was actually the name of the tribe. And the Visigoths and maybe some other folks as well. They did. Rome had kind of overstepped its geography. And actually, very similar situation that it overextended itself militarily and had, guess what, bases all over the world.
Oh, see how that worked out?
Yeah.
Do we never learn from history?
Yeah. Now, this right-wing talk show host, and there's something called Right Wing Watch, WATCH, not something you wear on your...
like they're looking out.
Hey, you know what? I was impressed. This is what a total aside. The president of our radio group was here visiting us, and he had a Detroit watch on it. He's from Boston.
He did.
Yeah, and he had a Shinola watch. Do folks know that? There's a Shinola watch and a Shinola bicycle company. And, that's kind of weird because Shinola was a shoe polish, but the old phrase, he doesn't know from Shinola.
Yeah. But this guy does.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's
wonderful.
I've actually seen bumper stickers that people have the full word out there.
Do they really?
I do know from Shinola. Could you imagine putting that on your bumper sticker?
No, I quit doing bumper stickers years ago. And I learned that lesson from a singer-songwriter friend of ours.
Yeah.
Who's kind of, some would consider controversial, David Rovics. But yeah. We think he's wonderful. And he just said, he goes, Julian, I'm on the road. I'm out here singing all these songs, that maybe some people wouldn't agree with, or maybe a police officer would say, he would be a right-wing guy and say, hey, this guy, I'm pulling him over. I quit doing it years ago.
Well, it's true. But I told you this, haven't I, that I used to have these anti-Bush and anti-Iraq bumper stickers.
Bush lied, people died. I had that on there for years.
And so I would.
And Blondes for Peace. Now that one was okay.
Really?
Yeah, I designed it myself online.
And I used to look in the mirror, and there'd be these guys. And you've heard me tell this. Haven't that? I was looking at it, and there's guys in these big Ford 150s glowing. They can kill me.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, wow, man, chill out. I mean, it's just a bumper sticker. So I got a new car, and then I didn't have any bumper sticker, and I look in the back, and the same guys. It just, everybody is just like...
It's the truck thing. Is that what you mean?
Oh, no, we're gonna get in trouble.
I know, but I get in my little car, and I drive down 8 Mile, and these guys are... You guys need to be nice to me in my little teeny car.
You think that the truck drivers are the worst? You know who...
No, I don't mean truck drivers. I mean in, like, the big...
No, I know. Big 150s,
yeah.
And Dodge Rams,
or
and
350s,
all that.
Or...
You know who's the absolute most aggressive drivers on the road today?
Who? Yes. Parents of students getting them to and from school.
Oh, I would say young women.
Oh, yeah? Could be. I drive, I guess I'm not necessarily young anymore, but I drive like a... Like a grandma. I'm safe.
Every time I look, there's these young women and just...
Probably talking on the phone, having a ciggy.
Right up. I told you about... Yeah, I did. About the woman in Royal Oak who was backing out, and I honked at her. And she was talking on the cell phone. I don't know how she did it. talking on the cell phone, smoking a cigarette, and gave me the finger.
Did she?
I don't know how she did it.
She's a multitasker on the road.
She really did it.
Well, I take my next door neighbor to school and pick him up quite often, and I'm somewhat of a surrogate mom to him, and I've been taking him to school since last week. And these mothers, it's mostly the mothers.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, they are cutthroat. Anyway, back to the. We drifted hard that time.
Yeah, back to the Christian radio host who said that he would go to gay weddings if they could tell him they had committed an abomination and shall be put to death.
Like, who's going to do that? Yeah. Who's putting them to death?
How about this? A former Navy chaplain. And this guy actually gave the invocation at some conservative convention. What's that? KPAC, or isn't it? CPAC. But he's a disgraced former Navy chaplain. He's calling on all photographers to print Bible scripture that says homosexuals are, quote, worthy of death.
My God!
Yeah. These are some sickos.
Whoa, how did they get that way? I wonder how they got that way. It's probably...
What happened? The New Mexico Supreme Court ruled unanimously against a Christian photographer who had discriminated against a same-sex couple. You can't discriminate against people. You can't say,
I mean, all you got to do is be a jerk and lie and say, I have another wedding that day.
Right. But he wants to put, that they should put on the back of their, the former Navy chaplain said he could come up with a solution. Wedding photographers should print on their business cards a Bible verse from Romans, well, I don't know how they say this, 132 or something, which he interpreted to mean that homosexuals were worthy of death.
Oh, God!
Yeah. Come and hire us. We'll do your wedding, but we're going to stamp on the back of every wedding photograph the scripture from Romans that tells you it's a sin. Boy, what a pack of sickos.
Yeah, they really are.
Yeah, they really are. Well, let's see. John has written in there, right by the Motor City Brewing Works. What were we talking about that's right by
because he went there, and we love the Motor City Brewing Works. I love that place.
Great pizza. And it has a beautiful deck. You know, Shinola. Shinola, the Shinola plant.
It's right there.
Yeah, right.
Oh, okay.
Right. Yeah.
By the way, they brew their own beer there.
They brew their own beer.
They make their own wine.
Oh, they do make their own wine?
Yeah. Yeah.
That's harder.
It's like blueberry wine. It's interesting. I taste it.
Well, I see by the clock
in
the wall.
We like to promote local businesses.
Yeah, we should go. So if you want to see Jalene and I, come to Royal Oak 12 Mile and Woodward. Woodward at 12 Mile in front of the Shrine of the Little Flower. And we are going to be saying no to bombing Syria.
Yes.
Thank you, John. Thanks for answering the phone.
John.
And we will be back next week. Stay tuned for the interviews.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more Night Call right after this.
These days, when I'm in a relationship, I feel like I'm alone.
Like there's no one behind the mask. No voice on the other end of the line. Are you looking for a car insurance policy totally devoted to you? At Geico.com, you'll find a sympathetic ear, a shoulder to cry on, butterfly kisses, and easy ways to pay your bill and manage your policy. We're waiting with bated breath to help you save money and talk about your feelings. Geico. 15 minutes could save you hundreds on car insurance.
Hey, Larry, mind if I sit down?
Nope.
This coffee tastes like coffee. So what's going on?
Not much.
What's new?
Not much.
Okay, but can you please put the newspaper down while you say not much?
What newspaper?
This newspaper. Oh, dude! What happened to your face? I see 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
Ow.
Dude, what is this? 11 pieces of toilet paper stuck to your face?
I'm shaving in the dark to save energy. I'm helping the environment.
That's a dangerous way to help the environment.
Well, sometimes you have to sacrifice yourself for the greater good.
Dude, there's an easier and safer way to help the environment without sacrificing yourself. Go green, go public. Take public transportation. It's good for the environment and you won't have to live behind a newspaper.
Wow.
But for now, put the newspaper back up.
A message from the public transportation systems across the country. To learn more, visit publictransportation.org.
Do you owe the IRS? Do you have unfiled tax returns? Have you received a wage garnishment or bank levy? Maybe a lien has been filed against you. OMG Tax can help you with all your IRS tax problems. Don't wait another second. Take action now. Call my team at OMG Tax. Honest and professional, we don't make false promises. If you owe back taxes or if the IRS is garnishing your paycheck, you need help now. OMG Tax can help you get your life back to normal. If you're serious about handling your tax matter, call OMG Tax now and get the peace of mind you deserve. Don't let the IRS take your next paycheck. Stop waiting and call our team at OMG Tax. OMG Tax has a straightforward, no-nonsense approach and has helped many Americans resolve their IRS nightmare. Call OMG Tax now.
Call 1-800-430-5474. That's 1-800-430-5474. 800-430-5474.
Now's the time.
Now's the time to make a difference.
Now's the time to do what's right.
To help a family.
Now's the time to volunteer.
To make a commitment.
To make new friends.
To make dreams come true.
To help a child.
Now's the time to help Habitat for Humanity build hope and change lives with a family in your community or around the world.
Now's the time.
Now, more than ever, help build it.
Visit Habitat.org.
WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. Steve and Chuck the Freak Mornings. 101 WRIF. Everything that rocks.
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Those of you who have listened to this broadcast for a long time know that I've interviewed Richard Heinberg any number of times. He's written 10 books about the environment. Maybe the best known are ones about peak oil, that we've reached a point where we just don't have, we're going down. I mean, we're, that's not there, that there's going to be an oil crisis, that eventually, and not too soon from now, we're going to run out. So what are we going to do? Well, the brainiacs behind the whole energy system have figured out we're going to be fracking. You know that phrase? We'll explain it in a while if you don't. We're going to be fracking for shale, gas, and oil. A lot of that's happening right here in our state. And this is great, they tell us. We're going to be freed from dependence on foreign oil. No more Saudi Arabia. No more Venezuela. It's going to be just homegrown. Sounds great to me, doesn't it? It doesn't to Richard Heinberg, who has written 10 previous books, including The Party's Over, Power Down, and The End of Growth. You can see a lot where this is going just by the titles, and I've interviewed him about these titles. He's a senior fellow at the Post Carbon Institute. We're reaching him in his office at the Post Carbon Institute in Santa Rosa, California. Richard Heinberg, as usual, welcome back to the Peter Werby Show.
Well, great to be speaking with you again, Peter.
And I should say, the name of your brand new book is Snake Oil, How Fracking's False Promise of Plenty Imperils Our Future. Well, the thesis is all right there, right? What's wrong with this? I mean, the only thing is we're now in our own backyard, right? Rather than despoiling nature, pumping oil out of Saudi Arabia and Venezuela and Canada and the U.S., we're going to be doing a lot of it here. So maybe we should even begin to make sure that everybody knows. What is fracking and that you designate as a snake oil proposition?
Well, fracking is really a set of technologies, including hydrofracturing, pumping millions of gallons underwater, millions of gallons of water underground to fracture tight rocks. Horizontal drilling, so instead of just drilling straight down, we drill down for, say, a kilometer or so and then turn the drill bit sideways to drill laterally into the oil or gas-bearing layer of rock. O-pad cluster drilling, drilling maybe 10 or even as many as 15 or 16 wells all in from one location to reduce costs. The development of a series of chemicals, slickening agents, and proppants to increase the rate of flow. All of this is a way of producing oil and gas from formations that geologists have known about for decades. These are formations that they call tight rocks. They're usually shale, but sometimes other kinds of rocks that have very low permeability and low porosity. So they've known that the oil and gas was there, but the rock is just so tight, so impermeable, that even if you drill a regular conventional oil well or gas well, you're not going to get very much of the oil or gas out. So the new technology was developed to release these fuels from these tight rocks. And the result has been pretty impressive. U.S. oil production is higher than it's been in years. U.S. natural gas production is at its highest point ever. And we're being told that this is going to go on for decades. And that's where the snake oil comes in.
Well, and it creates jobs. I've seen that on the television ads, too. We get jobs out of it. Domestic
Absolutely.
Jobs. Yeah, it sounds great.
Yeah, and the ads are prolific. We hear about the wonders of fracking almost on an hourly basis on ads on national, you know, radio networks and print and TV.
Except they don't mention fracking. They just say the domestic gas production usually, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So
yeah.
Where does the snake oil come in?
Well, the snake oil comes in from the fact that our energy conversation has changed on the basis of the promises that are being made. And we believe at Post Carbon Institute that these promises are not based on good data. We decided to do the numbers ourselves. We purchased the rights to drilling data on 65,000 oil and gas wells in the U.S. We looked at initial production rates of each well, the rate of decline in production from each well over time, the geographic location of the wells. And what we found was that in each of the geographic or geologic plays, people have heard of the Marcellus or the Eagle Ford or the Barnett, these are the large geographic areas where the geology is present to do fracking. In each of these large areas, there's a small core area or a sweet spot where production is prolific and profitable. But if you get outside those small areas, sometimes just a few counties, then initial production rates are much lower, and production declines very rapidly, usually in the range of 60 to 80 or even 90% in the first year. So we did the numbers, and it appears to us that U.S. shale gas and tight oil production is headed for a cliff probably around the end of this decade. It's probably going to level off and start to decline before we get to 2020. And that flies in the face of all of the claims of 100 years of cheap natural gas or the U.S. rivaling Saudi Arabia as a producer of oil. And yet we're currently making energy policy on the basis of the claims being made by the oil and gas industry.
Yeah. Richard Heinberg is my guest. His brand-new book from the Post Carbon Institute, which you can go to postcarbon.org, which I would highly recommend. His new book is called Snake Oil, How Fracking's False Promise of Plenty Imperils Our Future. Well, if it's going to run out by itself, I know that the environmental concerns that I hear from people and that I share is that it's doing great damage to our water, to our land. And yet, if it were talking about another 7 years, what's the harm? Let's get it while we can and rely less on foreign oil.
Well, of course, the problem is that with very high decline rates, per well decline rates, that means that the industry has to drill more and more all the time, and especially as they're forced to the periphery of these areas, as they fill up the core areas with wells and are forced to drill in worse and worse prospect areas. That means that the number of wells has to increase exponentially. So currently we're talking about several tens of thousands, maybe 70, 80,000 wells that have been drilled. Many more tens of thousands into the hundreds of thousands of wells are going to be drilled. So if the per well risk of environmental harm is low, as the industry claims, of say 1% likelihood of damaged well casing leading to contamination of water table, well, you multiply that by 100,000, 150,000 times, and you get thousands and thousands of instances of contaminated water tables or polluted groundwater. So this really is a very, very serious environmental concern.
Well, Richard Heinberg, I could imagine someone thinking, what do you environmentalists want? You don't want oil, you don't want coal, you don't want nukes, now you don't want this. What are we supposed to do? Sort of hand crank our radios and our televisions and our refrigerators? But this could be a serious consideration that maybe we are running out of options.
Well, see, that's the thing. we are going to lower and lower quality fossil fuels all the time. That's why we're in Canada producing tar sands or drilling in miles of ocean water in the Gulf of Mexico. It's because that's what's left. The handwriting is on the wall. Nature is telling us that we've got to move to different energy sources. And ultimately, they've got to be renewable energy sources because, you know, we're talking about the long run here. The whole fossil fuel era has just been a century or two. That's an eye blink of time in human history. And yet we've gotten used to that as if it were somehow normal. The reality is that normal is using renewable energy. That's what we humans did up until the fossil fuel revolution, and it's what we are going to be doing for the next several thousand years. It's just a question of how we transition back to using renewable energy. It doesn't mean we're going back to the Stone Age or even necessarily back to a 19th century way of life. Obviously, science has advanced. We have very advanced renewable energy technologies now, but you know, we're going to have to develop them and depend upon them much faster than we have been doing over the past few decades.
Richard Einberg, just parenthetically, maybe so people get an idea of what we're talking about when we've mentioned peak oil, and I don't think I did a very good job of explaining it in my introduction to you, and this is a concept you're well known for. Just real briefly, tell us about peak oil and the idea of peaks within energy sources, fossil fuel sources themselves.
Right. Well, this is a subject that has arrived at some prominence over the past few years, largely as a result of the work of an informal network of retired and independent petroleum geologists and engineers. They started seeing a few years ago the clear signs that the oil industry was going through a transformation. The industry today is drilling twice as many wells, investing twice as much capital in exploration and production, and deeply in debt, and the oil price has exploded from $20 a barrel a decade ago to about $105 a barrel today. And yet, with all of this, actual production has pretty much flatlined. If you just look at regular conventional crude oil, if you take away biofuels, natural gas, liquids, tar sands, and tight oil. Just look at regular conventional crude. It's actually been declining in production since about 2006. So we're hitting the law of diminishing returns. All the cheap, abundant oil that drove economic growth during the 20th century, the regular conventional stuff is pretty much gone, and we're replacing it with oil that costs more money to produce, but also more energy. So the energy payback for each unit of effort invested in oil exploration and production is declining. It's a clear sign that we're reaching the end of the road.
The book is Snake Oil, How Fracking's False Promise of Plenty Imperils Our Future. The author is my guest, Richard Heinberg. He works with the Post Carbon Institute in Santa Rosa, California. We're reaching him there. You go to postcarbon.org. Also, my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com, will have a link. I think if you took a poll of our audience, probably 90% of people listening, maybe everybody, would say, alternative fuels, alternative energy sources, sounds like a real good idea. The sun, water, you know, other aspects of that people are dealing with as alternatives to fossil fuels. What's the investment level in fossil fuels and as opposed to alternatives? Are we looking as a society at alternative fuels in a realistic way?
Well, the short answer is no. And that's part of the reason for the book. As I said at the beginning, our energy conversation has changed in this country. Just a few years ago, it was about how we needed to move away from dependence on oil because so much of it was imported. We knew that it was a depleting non-renewable resource. It was changing the climate and so on. But then once the oil industry had some success with hydrofracturing, the conversation changed, and I think this was a deliberate public relations ploy on the part of the industry, because they want America to continue to be dependent on oil and natural gas. And they want to discourage efforts to reduce that dependency. So this idea of abundance has really taken hold, and now we have a national energy policy of all of the above, which, as far as I can tell, is no different whatsoever from no energy policy at all. And our level of effort at making a transition to renewable energy sources has really slackened as a result of this. And I think this is a deadly scenario if we fall prey to the public relations of the industry.
I wonder if you're familiar with a book. I was trying to remember the author and can't. It's called simply Internal Combustion, or sort of the history of it and its development, its use in automobiles. Anyway, I'll try to find it. I'll have write a note to my producer, right, have her do it. But it had a section about how Thomas Edison was trying to convince Henry Ford to go all electric. And Edison had this vision of each home having a windmill that would power their automobiles and power lighting and electrical appliances. Of course, that never came to fruition. But some people have put forth, critics of people like yourself, have said that we just can't get enough out of the sun and water and the rest of it for a modern world technologically based economy. So, I mean, there's a lot in that. But essentially, could we realistically power everything, not only that we have now, but as more and more countries develop consumers that want cars and all the goodies we have, is this all possible?
Well, frankly, probably not. We have developed energy appetites based upon a temporary abundance of energy from fossil fuels, which are the most concentrated, cheap, abundant energy sources we've ever known. I mean, we have to give fossil fuels their due. You know, in their heyday, when we were finding gushers of oil in Texas and Oklahoma, you know, this was energy like we've never known before and probably will never know again in terms of its abundance and price. Renewable energy sources do have their drawbacks. Many of them are intermittent, like solar and wind. The sun's not always shining and so on. They have been expensive to develop, wind turbines, solar panels, but they are getting less expensive all the time. Technology is reducing the cost, whereas with fossil fuels, the cost is increasing even as we develop more sophisticated technology because they're based on depleting non-renewable resources. So even though there are some problems associated with renewable energy, and we can't necessarily expect the same level of, you know, fast-paced consumer lifestyle with solar and wind power that we had with, you know, the Beverly Hillbillies era of oil in the 20th century, nevertheless, that's our future. And it doesn't have to be a bleak future if we plan for it and if we develop those energy sources now rather than waiting till the last minute when we don't have the investment capital or the energy with which to do it.
The book, by the way, is written by Edwin Black, is an excellent writer. I interviewed him in 2006 when he published Internal Combustion, and I would advise, recommend, that's the word, recommend it as an understanding of the decision to go to the internal combustion engine. The book I'm interviewing the author of is Snake Oil, How Fracking's False Promise of Plenty Imperils Our Future. Fracking, bursting out gas and oil through the injection of water and chemicals into the earth to bring this stuff out. My guest is Richard Heinberg. He is a fellow with the Post Carbon Institute. You can go to postcarbon.org or my website, Peter. Go to his. You can always go to mine. Peter Werbe, WERBE.com. I'm just going to have a link to that, and there's incredible information there, as does the book Snake Oil. The structure of the book is very interesting because you also have these little bits, pages in there that say snake bites, and then this is the industry shills. The industry shills say that peak oil is not believable. World oil reserves are, in fact, increasing, and then you have the reality is. Maybe we can even tell us about that. You touched on it a little before. There's now with shale oil and And tar sands oil, that at least, does that mean at least statistically there's more oil available?
Right. You know, there are problems with accounting here, you know, because one barrel of regular conventional oil is not really equivalent in energy and environmental terms to a barrel of unconventional crude that's made from, oh, say, hydrofracturing or from tar sands. With the unconventional sources, the amount of energy that has to be invested in exploration and production is much, much higher. Energy experts sometimes talk about energy return on energy invested. It's like, you know, all financial analysts talk about return on investment. Well, there's energy return on investment as well. And society relies on a very, very high level of energy return on energy investment because almost everything we do requires energy. You know, agriculture and education and electronics and, you know, on and on, all use energy, but very little of the energy that we use goes into producing energy. So the energy that we invest as a society in drilling oil wells or building solar panels, that has to be very productive in order to produce enough surplus energy to fund all the other things we want to do. Well, with the unconventional oil sources, that energy profit ratio is very low, to the point where we really wouldn't be able to operate a modern industrial society if that's the only energy source that we had. So when we see that world oil production is still increasing, we have to parse that out and understand that almost all of the increase is coming from sources that are really problematic from an economic and environmental standpoint.
Well, the other thing that's rarely discussed, environmentalists raise it from time to time, is the idea of conservation. What a concept. I mean, when I think here, I think I'm pretty aware of environmental concerns, the impact of everything we've been talking about. And yet, I would say that without even trying, I could probably reduce the energy consumption in our house by, say, just 20%. That's without even trying, without keeping lights burning so much, with maybe the thermostat down a little, the air conditioning. I'm always fighting with my wife about, you know, it's 72. Let's turn on the air conditioning. No way. Would conservation have an impact?
Well, absolutely, and we're already doing it. You know, we Americans are using less oil today than we were 5 years ago. And in fact, if the trend of increase in oil consumption that we saw during the 80s and 90s had continued up to the present, we'd be using 20% more oil than we're actually using right now. Now, we should pat ourselves on the back for that, but it's come about not just because we've all decided to go out and buy hybrid cars or something, but it's mostly come about because oil prices are so high. Americans have just cut down on driving.
It is lessened. Let me, I just looking at the clock and my time with Richard Heinberg here in his new book, Snake Oil, is beginning to disappear. So we live in a world that is pretty much controlled economically and hence our energy sources by these multinational corporations who have no interest in getting off of fossil fuels. So what do we do? I know there's in every state, including Michigan here, and I'll have a link on my website to the groups that are doing this, are opposing fracking. What do we do to get off this road that just leads to, as you said earlier, a cliff?
Right. Well, we have to do two things. One is oppose the expansion of fossil fuel production and consumption and in all of its forms, coal, oil, natural gas. And fracking is a good place to start because it is so environmentally risky. But the other thing we have to do is develop alternative sources of energy and energy conservation. And we need to be putting a lot more effort along those lines. Because the energy conversation in the country has changed, we have really, you know, taken our eye off the ball in terms of alternative energy production. We can't afford to do that. We have a relatively a brief amount of time in which to develop renewable energy before fossil fuels become just economically prohibitive.
Well, let me just put this in. The clock is ticking, so let me get this from you as quickly as I can. And that is, you use the pronoun we. The we here, unfortunately, are these big energy companies. What can you and I do to develop alternative sources?
Right, right. Well, of course, we can reduce our personal energy consumption. We can walk and bicycle a lot more and drive a lot less. We can put solar panels on the roofs of our houses and solar hot water and so on. All of these things are possible. They're, you know, some of them take some investment, like solar panels and so on. But over time, this is what we have to do. And, you know, life is actually better when we do these things. My wife and I have lived this way for over 10 years with solar electricity and hot water and gardening and chickens in the backyard. And, you know, life is way better than just living the standard consumptive, consumer-driven American model.
Absolutely. Well, I want to thank you so much, as usual, Richard Heinberg, for being with me. Go to the postcarbon.org website and you'll learn more about this. You can get Richard Heinberg's latest book, which is Snake Oil, How Fracking's False Promise of Plenty Imperils Our Future. Also, you can go to Richard Heinberg, that's HEINBERG.com, for more information. And I'll have all of this on my website as well, Peter Werbe, WERBE.com. Richard Heinberg, thanks for, as always, for being on the broadcast.
It's always a pleasure, Peter.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with another guest right after this.
This next song goes out to someone real special. Web developers. You've developed a World Wide Web of convenience, and Geico.com is eternally grateful. Now everyone can pay bills, manage policies, maybe save big money on car insurance, all from the comfort of their desk chairs, recliners, and waterbeds. You're magicians with wands made of binary code. And that's why we're sending this next song out to you. For a free rate quote, visit Geico.com.
My dad is my hero. He goes into burning buildings. He finds people inside who need to be saved. He helps them get out, even when he can't breathe or see or is a little scared. My dad is a firefighter, but the best thing he can do is come home.
The U.S. Fire Administration reminds you to protect yourself and firefighters. Have smoke alarms on every level and near sleeping areas. Test them monthly. Change batteries as instructed. Install sprinklers. Do your part to get out before firefighters have to come in. The fact is, most fire deaths occur in homes with no working smoke alarms. The good news is, that's a fact we can change. Smoke alarms save lives. Find out more at usfa.dhs.gov.
Attention business owners, this is Tony Robbins. I've spent the last 3 decades helping companies create serious business breakthroughs, and I want to help you like never before.
And this is Chet Holmes, author of the #1 business book, The Ultimate Sales Machine. If you've heard my radio spots before, maybe you don't know that about 2,000 action-oriented business owners call us every week to get our free reports. But it was Tony Robbins that challenged me to go even further for you.
Chet and I have built a serious training program called 4 Ways to Double Sales in 12 Months.
And here's what Tony convinced me to do.
We're going to give this to any business owner who calls us at 800-936-0222. Just call with your email address and we'll email you this phenomenal audio training program at our expense, not yours.
It's a heck of a gift. See if you agree. 4 ways to double sales in 12 months.
Call and leave us a voicemail with your email and we'll give you a program that others have paid dearly to receive. Call right now. That's 1-800-936-0222.
These days, people of all ages, including adults, can have a perfect smile. Thanks to today's technology, people with crooked teeth may no longer need to wear metal braces. One option many adults prefer is invisible braces. Instead of the typical metal bands or brackets that are cemented to teeth, These braces are clear plastic trays. Some advantages of invisible braces are they can be removed for eating and for brushing and flossing. They are practically invisible to see, and they are less irritating to gums than traditional braces. Keep in mind that invisible braces are only available for people who need minor corrective work. If you are considering braces and would like to learn more about invisible braces, speak with your dentist. You're never too old for a beautiful smile. For the ADA Dental Minute, I'm Dr. Maria Lopez-Howell. For more information, visit our website at ada.org.
Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much. Peter Werby here with you. Thank you for listening. September 11th, that's a date that's stuck in all of our minds, I'm sure. Something that resonates as a national tragedy. But, you know, there's another September 11th, and that was September 11th, 1973 in Chile. And you may remember, we've spoken in the past with Peter Kornbluh. Peter Kornbluh is the director of the Cuba and Chile documentation projects at the National Security Archives in Washington. And there was a coup, a military coup, on September 11th, 1973. So it's the 40th anniversary there. And a reissued book on what occurred. And you'll understand very quickly why this is of importance to us here in the United States. The book is called The Pinochet File, a declassified dossier on atrocity and accountability. And it's a National Security Archive book. Peter Kornbluh has been on the program before. We welcome him back. He's at his office in Washington, D.C. Peter, welcome back to the broadcast.
It's a great pleasure to be with you again, Peter Werby.
And I remember you said last time we talked, you're an old Detroit hand.
I grew up in Ann Arbor, and so I'm a Motown boy on the outskirts, and I used to listen to you and your stations when I was much younger. When we were both much younger.
I was going to say, I was younger also. Well, let's look at your book, The Pinochet File, a declassified dossier on atrocity and accountability. On the face of it, that might not resonate with a lot of people. Tell us about September 11th, not 2001, but 1973, 40 years ago.
Well, Chile had its own 9/11, and the 40th anniversary is coming up in just a few days. And it was an extraordinarily bloody coup, overthrowing the democratically elected government of Salvador Allende and putting in power the rather infamous now regime of General Augusto Pinochet, whose name became quickly synonymous with gross violations of human rights and international terrorism as well. So this was a regime that was in power for 17 years. Its first years in power, its years of consolidation, it had the strong backing of the United States government, first President Nixon, then Gerald Ford. The key actor in Washington was Henry Kissinger. And this is an event that actually resonates through, obviously, the history of Chile, but also the history of Latin America and the history of the world, because Chile, much like Fernando Franco's Spain, became a symbol. And it remains a symbol today, and that's why we're talking about it again.
And you just have come back from Chile. Is that correct, Peter Kornbluh?
Just yesterday morning. I returned from 10 days in Chile to see what Chileans are doing to commemorate the 40th anniversary of this coup. And there's an extraordinary dynamic going on down there, I'll tell you. Right-wing politicians and key actors who supported the coup are coming forward now and saying they're apologizing for their support for repression. It's become clear that public opinion in Chile is overwhelmingly against anybody who's an apologist for the Pinochet regime at this point. And there's just, you know, one extraordinary cultural event after another. There's a series of TV programs about the coup and about the repression. And so the country is rather transfixed, actually, at the moment with this anniversary.
Well, people may know, at least the broad outlines, that like any fascist government, any undemocratic government, it was repressive. How bad was it? How many people did the government kill of its opponents? And I notice also it says your book, The Pinochet File, that you've collected these documents and have commentary, a declassified dossier on atrocity and accountability. I don't want to really make people, you know, well, maybe we should face it, but because we do about our 9/11, the atrocity was what? They just executed people, and what was the nature of all that? And as I said, how many?
Well, the atrocities were twofold, really. In some ways, there was the repression following the coup. The first, I think, 3 or 4 or 5 weeks after the coup, more than 1,500 people were killed, rounded up, tortured, executed. Over the course of 17 years, more than 3,200 people were murdered. 1,100 of them were disappeared, los desaparecidos. Their bodies have never been found. Their families are still looking for them to this very day. I met at least 5 family members who are just desperate still 40 years later to find out what happened to their loved ones, who they've never seen again. More than 40,000 people were tortured during the 17 years of Pinochet's regime. So there are quite a few torture victims who are still seeking justice as well. That's part of the atrocity. I think part of the atrocity is the U.S. role in undermining democracy in Chile and supporting a military dictatorship there. And the documents that are published in my book are the internal secret documents of operations, of decisions made by Nixon and Kissinger and others to undermine the elected government of Salvador Allende and then help the military ascend to power and even help them institute the repressive practices in the first 3 years of the Pinochet regime that they undertook. It was only when Pinochet sent his secret police agents to Washington, D.C., the capital city of the United States of America, to blow up one of his opponents right in downtown Washington, that the United States began to rethink its position on supporting him.
Peter Kornbluh, you are the director of the Cuban-Chile Documentation Project at the National Security Archives. What brought you to this? Was it just general interest? Did you have any more direct contact with something that motivated you to do this kind of deep research on this?
You know, I'd love to say it was my conscience and my historical interest in uncovering the secret history of our foreign policy, and it became that. But in the first days, it was a girl, Peter. It was a Chilean teenage girl in my high school who I met the day after the coup 40 years ago. And she told all of us who were in the class that day of what was going on in her country, what had just happened, and it stayed with me. And when I went off to college just a few months later, I decided that I really wanted to focus on what the United States had done in the name of the American public in Chile, in our name but without our knowledge. And it took years and years, decades, to uncover and get declassified these secret documents, which include Kissinger's conversations with Richard Nixon, which include, you know, CIA instructions to its station in Santiago about how to foment a climate for a coup, you know, which include the investigation into the terrorist attack in Washington, D.C., the murders of Orlando Letelier and Ronnie Moffitt, which include the case of Charles Horman, an American citizen who was in Chile at the time of the coup and was taken prisoner from his house by the military and executed in the National Stadium. A whole movie called Missing was made about him, starring Jack Lemmon and Sissy Spacek. I still work with Charlie Horman's wife, Joyce, on their case. It was an effort, I think, to hold the United States accountable for its foreign policy and to look again at the issue of human rights. We did not have a human rights policy in this country until after the coup in Chile, when the American people rose up and said, you know, we don't want this. We don't want to be overthrowing democratically elected governments, and we don't want to be embracing bloody military dictators. And so the first laws were passed making human rights a criteria in U.S. foreign policy, and that's one of the reasons why Chile is so important.
Well, in your book, The Pinochet File, A Declassified Dossier on Atrocity and Accountability, you have, as you said, these instructions from the White House and from Kissinger, the CIA, and one wonders why they saw Salvador Allende, the democratically elected president that was, if I remember correctly, was elected in 1970 when Nixon was still at his height and hadn't been disgraced yet. Why they were so concerned that Allende was a socialist? I mean, he didn't threaten the major means of production. He wasn't going to nationalize, or was he? Why were they so concerned about overthrowing him?
Well, he was going to nationalize the copper industry in Chile, which was Chile's main national resource and which was completely dominated, owned, controlled by U.S. corporations. But, you know, his moderate opposition, the Christian Democrats, were moving towards nationalizing copper as well because it's something that the vast majority of Chilean people wanted. But, you know, I asked myself that question at the time. And then I spent years and years looking for the actual document which would tell me. And it was only, if you can believe it, in 2004, so many years later, almost 30 years after the coup, that I finally found a memo, top secret, that Kissinger had written to Nixon just on the day that Allende was being inaugurated. I mean, this was all a preemptive strike. He hadn't even actually set foot in the Chilean White House, if you will. And already Kissinger and Nixon had decided they had to, quote, bring him down, unquote. And this secret document, which is in the new edition of the book that's available to all your listeners, tells us exactly what was on Kissinger's mind. And one of the key things that was on his mind was truly the fact that Allende had been elected democratically and that he had complete legitimacy and that the United States couldn't challenge him as it might challenge a Fidel Castro in Cuba or, you know, the Sandinista government in Nicaragua, you know, because he hadn't come to power through armed revolution and overthrown another government. He had been elected by the people. And if he was successful in redistributing wealth in Chile, nationalizing U.S. interests, U.S. corporate interests in mining, et cetera, and other countries saw him as successful, then Kissinger feared what he called the imitative spread of this phenomena. And he wasn't just worried about it spreading to other countries in Latin America. He was worried about Europe. And countries like Italy, he actually tells Richard Nixon, you know, this type of model could spread to Italy and other countries, and that would affect the NATO, you know, alliance, and that would affect the world balance of power and our interests in it, you know, vis-a-vis the Soviet Union. So from a kind of Cold War chessboard point of view, his basic position was, we have to make Allende fail so no other country wants to go ahead and go and democratically elect socialist communist coalitions and change their systems that way. You know, violence be damned, we have to do this. And he didn't give a rat's ass for human rights issues and embraced Pinochet as soon as he came to power.
The book is The Pinochet File. Pinochet was the general who overthrew the democratically elected government of Chile on September 11th, 1973. So as Peter Kornbluth, the author and my guest, has said, it is their 9/11. It's being commemorated with great sorrow in the country of Chile, where Peter Kornbluth has just returned from. Tell us three stories, if you will, which will, I think, give a good picture of what occurred. Take us back to that day, September 11th, 1973, and the military uprising and the fate of the democratically elected president, Salvador Allende.
Well, the CIA had been working for 3 years on the instructions of Richard Nixon to create a climate of instability and to garner the support of the military and the middle-of-the-road political parties to overthrow Allende. And when the day finally came, Allende, the presidential palace was bombed by jets piloted by the Chilean Air Force, and tanks bombarded the presidential palace. And Allende made a final speech to his nation, basically saying, you know, I may not survive today, but, you know, the cause of justice and truth will live on. He did die during the coup. He actually took his own life. Thousands of people were rounded up. We have the reports to Kissinger on the secret reports on the repression in the days that followed. Thousands of people were taken to the National Stadium. There, this most famous Chilean folk singer, kind of the Pete Seeger of Chile, Victor Jara, was executed. His case is in the news today and yesterday and today, and it'll be in the news tomorrow because the guy who shot him is living happily in Florida and has become a U.S. citizen. And so the quest to bring these atrocities to accountability and hold the perpetrators accountable and bring them into court has now come to the United States of America because somehow the family of Victor Jara wants to the United States government to send this individual back to Chile to stand trial four years later.
Let me interrupt because that was one of the people I was going to ask you to talk about. And if you want to look him up, Victor Jara, it's J-A-R-A, and in Spanish, Jara. He was rounded up and put in this sports stadium and where these Chilean troops just would randomly open fire into the people that were had been crowded in there. And Victor Jara, because of his incredible singing and his songs of social consciousness, was beaten back badly, and I've heard at times that because he was a guitarist, his fingers were cut off. Is that an understanding? Well,
there's a lot of folklore around the way he was killed, and most I think most recently Pete Seeger told the story that he had heard of Jara having his hands smashed with rifle butts and then told to play the guitar for, you know, the whole stadium to listen to. That isn't the evidence that is in the indictment and in a lawsuit that just filed yesterday by the Jara family against Pedro Barrientos, this individual who's living in Florida right now. The evidence in those suits, based on other soldiers who were in the room, say that Jara was taken down to be interrogated in a locker room. He was severely beaten there with his hands behind his back. Pedro Barrientos kind of tormented him with a game of Russian roulette until he finally just shot him in the back of the head. And then ordered his troops who were there in the room with him to kind of, you know, machine gun the body so that it wouldn't be clear that he had simply been executed with a shot to the back of the head. And the body was then dumped. Victor Jara's body was then dumped on the street and retrieved by, you know, policemen out there later and taken to a morgue. And this is emblematic, by the way. I mean, there were two Americans who were also held in the stadium, and they were also executed, Charlie Horman and Frank Teruggi. And that case is one where the United States obviously has very clear interest in justice being done. And still today, 4 years later, the people that killed them have not been held accountable. I'm going tomorrow to New York to see both the sister of Frank Teruggi and the wife of Charles Horman, Joyce Horman. There'll be a big event there to kind of commemorate and push for the pursuit of justice 4 years later. So these are cases that are still outstanding, and they are testament to the interest in Chileans and the families of all these victims to find truth and justice for their loved ones.
Well, and if anyone out there thinks, geez, 40 years later, why are they still after this guy? You got to remember, the United States is still, and Europeans are still prosecuting Nazi concentration camp guards, some who are in their 80s.
That's exactly right.
Yeah. So
exactly right. These are the types of crimes that simply cannot be forgotten. And are not being forgotten. And that's why I think there still is interest in radio shows like the one you're doing now and books like the one I just did and the documents that are there for everybody to read.
And the book is The Pinochet File, a Declassified Dossier on Atrocity and Accountability. The URL, the website address, is way too long to give on the air, but I will have a very distinct direct connection and link to it on my website, Peter Werbe, WERBE.com, and also it'll be on my Facebook page.
Let me just say that we do have a short website,
NSArchive.org. NSArchives.org?
Not with an S, not plural. NSArchivesingular.org.
Okay, good, good.
And there you'll see postings, and you can search for Chile, Kissinger, and all the documents will come up.
Henry Kissinger now, who for a long time never even wanted his voice recorded because he had a German accent, and the mastermind in many ways behind the coup in Chile on September 11th, 1973. As they say, he's fat and happy, isn't he? He's never been called to the bar of justice for the many crimes he's committed.
I just got back from Chile, Peter, and I was on CNN Chile and a lot of radio stations and interviewed by the newspapers there, and everybody asked me, every single reporter asked me, why can't Kissinger be held legally accountable for his role in the atrocities and the coup here? And it was very difficult for me to explain why he can't be. And certainly the most important thing, if he can't be legally held accountable, is to hold him accountable in the court of American public opinion and world public opinion. And the documents are incredibly detailed. They show that he had deputies in his office who tried to persuade him not to go forward with intervention in Chile. They show that he had a deputy who told him that Pinochet was now synonymous with human rights violations, that he shouldn't support him. They show that one of his aides came to him following the coup and said, you know, the reports are that there are 10,000 bodies in the streets. What do I tell the U.S. Congress? And Kissinger says, you tell them that this new military regime is better for our interests than the one before. The documents speak for themselves, and they show the degree to which Kissinger was the key U.S. official pushing for a policy to overthrow democracy in Chile and to embrace military dictatorship there. He certainly had the president, you know, on his back and behind him. When you read the historical record, you see that it really came down to this one person who pushed forward with these policies, even as other agencies in the U.S. government and his own deputies tried to dissuade him from these immoral and ultimately counterproductive policies.
Some people have said that Henry Kissinger can't even travel everywhere out of fear of arrest. Is that
well,
so?
That's true. You know, your listeners may remember that Augusto Pinochet, years after he was pushed aside and democracy returned to Chile, traveled to London in 1998 and was arrested there. And he was kept under house arrest for more than a year as Spain tried to obtain his extradition to Madrid to stand trial for crimes against humanity. Eventually, he went back to Chile, but there he was prosecuted by judges in his own country, and he died on International Human Rights Day, December 10th, 2006. He was under six different indictments for human rights crimes and for corruption when he passed away. But Pinochet's arrest created something called the Pinochet effect, and it created a new verb in the lexicon of the human rights movement, to be Pinochet. And Kissinger was actually the first guy to be Pinochet. He went to France, and then a judge came and served him with a subpoena in a case of human rights atrocities in Chile, and instead of answering the subpoena, he left France. He was going to go to Brazil to receive a big award, and a Brazilian judge let it be known that if he came there, he would be questioned for these crimes committed in Chile and by the Pinochet regime and his knowledge and support of them, and so he canceled his trip to Brazil. And yes, he at one point in the mid, 2001, 2002, he would send his aides out to any country he went to make sure that there wasn't some outstanding, you know, legal action against him.
Does he defend his role in Chile? Does he deny it? Does he defend it?
Yeah, he's been asked. Elizabeth Farnsworth of the McNeil Air NewsHour sat in front of him and said, when you met with Pinochet, why didn't you just say, you know, you've killed people, you're disappearing people, just don't do it anymore, just stop it. And he explained to her that human rights wasn't, a particularly salient issue in the mid-1970s. Well, it became a salient issue precisely because he was supporting these gross violations that were going on, and the American people said, basta, said enough of this. And a number of laws were passed that constrained now the ability of presidents and secretary of state to simply give military aid to any military regime that violates the human rights of their people.
Peter Kornbluh, we just have about 60 seconds left. I'll let it leave it to you to sum up. What does this all tell us? So what we're now opposing dictators, usually, maybe not all of them, but a lot of them. What does this tell us as a country?
Well, it tells us that a country that we have a long history of secrecy, of abuse of power, but that we also have a history of the American people standing up for human rights and the cause of democracy, and that we need less secrecy and less abuse of power. And the only way for that is to look at the historical record, engage in the debate over the morals that our own country needs to stand for, and make sure that there isn't another time when a Chile comes to pass. That Chile's 9/11 is the last of that kind of abuse of power that we see in the world. It's difficult, but at least the process of the pursuit of truth and justice goes forward and helps by the evidence that we have in the declassified U.S. documents.
And incredibly assembled in the Pinochet file, a declassified dossier on atrocity and accountability. Peter Kornbluh has written it and collected the documents. There is also audio clips available at nsarchive.org. All of this will be linked on my website, peterwerbe.com, and also on my Facebook page. Peter Kornbluh, as usual, thanks for doing this, and thanks for doing the broadcast.
Thank you for listening to Night Call on 101 WRIF. The views expressed on the program are not necessarily those of the staff, management, or ownership of WRIF Radio. Now, stay tuned for more Rip Rock on 101 WRIF Detroit.
All you ladies and gents out there enjoying the smooth sounds of the interwebs radio, Geico's got a special dedication to make. This one goes out to the inventors of the mouse. Because of you and your rodent-inspired design, people can click on over to Geico.com to pay their bills, manage their claims, and live lives of pure savings. Mouse Masters, you've clicked your way into our hearts for good. Enjoy this next song. It's going out to you. Geico, 15 minutes could save you hundreds on car insurance.
My mom is my hero. She goes into burning buildings. She finds people inside who need to be saved. She helps them get out, even when she can't breathe or see or is a little scared. My mom is a firefighter, but the best thing she can do is come home.
The U.S. Fire Administration reminds you to protect yourself and firefighters. Have smoke alarms on every level and near sleeping areas. Test them monthly. Change batteries as instructed. Install sprinklers. Do your part to get out before firefighters have to come in. The fact is, most fire deaths occur in homes with no working smoke alarms. The good news is, that's a fact we can change. Smoke alarms save lives. Find out more at usfa.dhs.gov.
Oh, my God!
Get all of Dave and Chuck the Freak's best moments delivered right to your computer or mobile device. Brought to you by the Specs Howard School of Media Arts. Subscribe today at WRIF.com. Back to the Rock on the Riff.
WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit.
Detroit's new home for Dave and Chuck the Freak is 101 The Riff.
My name is Kid.
you know about sacrifice when the lights go out? The